You're listening to Nowhere in Mulberry. Film, television, and pop culture. It's where you find it.
Everybody, it's me, the J-Strom. We're here in Mulberry, and I'd like to welcome you to a very special show. This is our first ever Mulberry Saloon episode. No, I'm kidding. Well, no, it could be, because I have here Andy of the Hollywood Saloon. How you doing, Andy?
Hello, thank you for having me, sir.
Could we call this the Mulberry Saloon, or should it be the Mulberry Cantina, something like that?
Let me check with my lawyers. And then I'll get back to you on that.
How about right. Nowhere in Andy?
Nowhere in Andy.
Perfect.
We also have here today my dad, Terry.
I'm Dad Terry.
The Terrorstrom, as I say. I'm the J-Strom, he's the Terrystrom.
The father.
I was the cookie cutter. J-Strom is the cookie.
now we know where all the madness came from.
Yeah. It's your fault.
It's like feet. It runs in the family.
Now, the reason I have brought Andy and my father together is a mutual love of film music.
Absolutely.
Yes, film composers. At one time, Dad, maybe a little obsessed with collecting
not
film
a little.
Scores. Yeah, not a little. Andy, were you ever obsessed with collecting film scores from movies, or are you still?
Well, I still am, and it's a lot easier today, obviously, because we can just, you know, seek them out and find them online. And I don't really own the score like I can hold it in my hand, but at least I have the music. And so, oh, yeah, I mean, as much as I can find, if it's, you know, stuff that I like, so sure.
Now, we're going to talk about all sorts of different aspects of film music and composing, but maybe if we jump around a little bit, it's okay if people follow us. The first thing I'm wondering and I'm curious about, the first time Dad and Andy, you were conscious of film music.
1951.
Okay.
I was 4 years old. My mother took me to see the science fiction movie, The Thing from Another World.
Wow.
It was Dmitri Tiomkin's music. And I was consciously aware as a little child that what's scaring the bejeez out of me was the music. And I just made the cognition that because that music is playing, it's making me feel this dread.
Right.
And I would play, you know, like kids would play with cars and things. I would play, and I would do the music with my mouth. You know, I'd go, rum, rum. I make all these sounds because I connected that.
Right.
And from that time on, I was always listening for the music, or if I noticed on the billboard that a particular composer was going to be doing the score, I would go see a movie just because I knew I would like the music.
Really? Huh. You just started paying, like, recognizing...
I don't know why.
Who's composing. Now, what about you, Andy?
Oh, well, you know, it always comes back to the same thing with me, and it's kind of sad, really. You know what I'm going to say, but it's 1977.
Right.
And it's Little John Williams and a little movie you might have heard of called Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew of, you could help me with this, Mr. Jastrom there, is what is it, Also Sprach Zarathustra?
In
2001.
Yeah, a little 2001. And I was aware of that, obviously. And that was actually one of the first soundtracks that I owned. I remember my parents, my dad was so proud when we got a cassette player. And I told him, and this, I guess this was in 77. I guess I would have been 9. So I think I also had, like, you know, movies, you know, albums like you would sing to. I know, and I forgot what year Grease was, but we had Grease and, you know, all the garbage that I had yeah. when I was a kid. And, but I think when Scores hit, it was 2001 in Star Wars. And I remember we got that cassette deck and my dad wanted to get Star Wars, but they were out. So he brought home 2001, and boy, what a difference. I was like, he goes, here, well, listen to this. And I went, that's not no Star Wars. That sounds, that doesn't sound like Star Wars. But I remember, yeah, and I think it was, that was when it first became real to me, was definitely with Star Wars and John learning about Williams. John Williams and then, yeah. you know, leapfrogging to all of his scores.
Yeah, I think a lot, John Williams for a lot of people was the most recognizable.
Yeah, there are generational, I guess you can say, chapters between people. The older you are, a different generation you came in on, mm-hmm. and a different kind of soundtrack music is what you warm to. Like, I came in on the golden age where you still mm-hmm. had, like, Tiomkin and Max Steiner and, you know, Elmer Bernstein, people like that. Then there's the Silver mm-hmm. Age. And I don't know what they're calling it now, but it's kind of the post-Silver Age.
The
and,
Dirt Age.
yeah, kind of the Generation X age.
Now, at what time, like when you first mentioned that The Thing, did you have like that favorite? Like, oh, this guy's my favorite right now.
Yeah, and there were hardly any soundtrack albums available mm-hmm. in the 40s and 50s. It started in the 50s slowly, but I didn't own my first soundtrack until about 1962 or 63, and that was Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, awesome. Nice. Maurice Jarre?
Yeah. I thought Maurice Jarre was going to be my new favorite composer, but something happened to him. It's an interesting story, but it's too many details.
You mean his quality of music?
The orchestration, the actual which instruments are chosen to play
right.
for Lawrence of Arabia were not his doing. It was a fellow named Gerard Sherman.
And you think that guy did him in or something?
No, he made it great.
Oh, okay.
And
wow. The opposite.
About the time he started doing Ryan's Daughter and Passage in India, he started doing his own orchestrations. And the fall off, the difference in the sound and the presentation was day and night for me. So I just almost completely lost interest.
I would never even put that together and go, he's starting to suck.
Well, you know, a similar... There's kind of a parallel there if we go to Dr. No, for example.
Right.
A guy who had written musicals, Monty Norman, was called in because he was a friend of Cubby Broccoli to do the music for this secret agent movie called Dr. No. And Monty Norman gave him Three Blind Mice and Underneath the Mango Tree because he was kind of a songwriter. And when they put his music against the film, the film editor, Peter Hunt, said, "This is like Mining Disaster. His background score just doesn't work for this. We got to do something." So they approached this fellow named John Barry, who had just started to get into movies, and he was doing some popular music. So they said, "Let's see if he can't punch this up." So Monty Norman hands him a slip of paper. I've seen it. I have a photographic copy of it. Crumpled piece of paper with a few notes on it that he was trying to use notes from a song he'd written That was from a musical he's working on called Mr. Biswas. And it was Good Sign, Bad Sign. It was, I was born with a bad sign. That's it. That's all that was on there. Handed it to John Barry, and this was on a Friday, and said, we need something by Monday. So Barry looked at it. He tried to work around with it and finally threw it away, and he came up with what we now have as the James Bond theme. Arranged it, orchestrated it, rewrote it, and went into the recording studio and gave it to them for, and he was paid £200.
But of course, you know, every time we hear the Bond score now, we have to say, Bond to Norman.
Yeah, it was a contractual obligation, and John Barry thought it was kind of a one-off, one-time deal. He sold the rights to it, and then when he went to see the film, he saw it was all over the film, and it was important. And he went to the producers and he said, what's going on here? You know, this is more important than you made it out to be. They said, don't worry, we'll take care of you. And the reason I brought that up in relation to Maurice Jarre is what Barry provided is so different from what Monty Norman provided in that movie.
Totally.
That when you think of James Bond, you're not thinking of what Monty Norman did for Dr. No, or even that little I was born under a bad sign snippet. But Monty Norman has the legal right to it. And so if you'll notice, John Barry avoids using the James Bond theme throughout the whole series, and the producers kept going back in and throwing the James Bond theme in there. None of that was John Barry's idea. He would use his 007 theme,
right?
Or he would use the rising and falling figure, you know, the dum-dum-dum, or the ba-dum-ba-dum. But he avoided the dum-diddy-dum-dum as much as he could. Whenever you hear it in a Bond film, the producers have gone back in and thrown it in.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird what goes on.
Yeah.
I love the way that they did use that 007 theme, and they really pushed it. And I remember it going all the way up until, I think Live and Let Die was the last time we heard the 007 theme. Am I right?
Moonraker, he had it in it.
Oh, cool. So he had it at Moonraker, too. Yeah, and I remember that they wanted so hard for that to be the theme. But again, like you said, they always went back, and that's the one that caught. And lucky for Monty Norman. And I don't know, does that mean he still gets a check to this day?
Absolutely.
Or his family?
When there was litigation, I think it was about 5 years ago, Monty Norman will take to court anybody who says that he didn't write it. And during the court proceedings, you can read about it online, the details of it. It showed that he gets close to $250,000 a year off
wow.
the James Bond
thing,
nice.
Just having his name attached to it.
I always wonder how much that bothers John Barry, because he's one.
Enormously.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say, hasn't he been way more successful in his life and his body of work than Monty Norman?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And he's won Academy Awards.
Five Academy Awards, Golden Globe Awards, BAFTA Awards.
And yet, I've read where people said, if you listen to the James Bond theme and Monty Norman's other music, you can tell he wrote it.
Yeah, I think Monty Norman started that rumor.
And when you listen to it, I may be biased because I always heard John Barry coming from the other room as a child, but it doesn't sound like it sounds like John Barry music to me.
Yeah, if you play Beat Girl, for example, which was the first soundtrack ever released in Great Britain, by the way, that was the film that John Barry broke into film music with. If you listen to Beat Girl and the twangy guitar. And
yeah,
the
Vic Flick guitarist.
You can just see how that is. That has the sound and it has the attitude.
Right. It's the same guitar twang and everything.
Yeah.
And that was before he ever got the job on
Dr.
No,
too,
isn't it? So that's very interesting.
But there have been successful people that composed for films that couldn't even write music. I mean, Lionel Bart, who wrote the theme for From Rush with Love.
Really?
They were going to have him do the score, and the producers discovered that he couldn't read or write music. He just he whistled. And so Bart and Barry were friends.
That'd be an interesting soundtrack.
So Bart and Barry were friends. They both worked for the same recording company, EMI. And he says, you know, why don't you come with me and you can orchestrate and arrange and, you know, compose the rest of the score. So that's how he just segued right into the Bond films.
Nice.
So this sort of thing, people can have careers like that in film. Mm. Because in America, it's a union rule that someone else has to orchestrate. So when John Barry came to America in 1965 to do King Rat, he couldn't believe that the composers didn't arrange and orchestrate and conduct themselves.
Interesting.
But it was a rule.
Do they do it anymore, or do they all do it now?
Well, I can only think of one composer who had it in his contract that nobody could touch his music except himself, and that was Bernard Herrmann of Psycho fame.
Wow.
North by Northwest. Yeah.
He did everything himself. Also, Ennio Morricone.
Ooh.
He does everything himself.
A god, if you will.
An absolute.
Now, what about someone like Danny Elfman? Doesn't he have all of his friends?
Now, Danny Elfman, who came out of Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo and then later Oingo Boingo, he came up with his own music notation system, and people would make fun of him because he wasn't a legitimate composer. He had a synclavier, and he would mock up the orchestrations on the synclavier, which is like the Rolls Royce of synthesizers.
Nice.
He went back to school and learned proper notation and everything because he couldn't stand being mocked and, you know, made fun of.
It didn't matter what the music sounded like. It was how the fact that he did it that way.
When you're a success, people will find every reason in the world to put you down.
And, you know, I remember at the time reading about the Elfman haters.
Oh, yeah.
When he was doing, like, every comic book type movie.
Yeah.
You know, Dick Tracy, Batman, and all that. That people were like, I hate it. It's all the same. It's all cookie cutter. It's like, okay, well, I guess there's something wrong with me because I have no problem with it.
Well, his sound radically changed when he started doing his own orchestrations.
His music isn't like that. I almost think of it as being a kid in a candy store to maturing, and I'm not really into his mature stuff.
Well, about the time of Black Beauty, I don't know if anybody's ever seen, I think it was in the 80s. That's a gorgeous, just a fantastic score. I think it's the best thing he ever did.
Wow.
Danny Elfman?
Danny Elfman.
Wow, never heard of it.
Yeah.
Is it a horse movie?
It is indeed. No, it's not a black exploitation film.
No, it's about Cleopatra Jones, Black Beauty.
Nice. Exactly.
Well, here we could take this conversation to a dramatic turn, and that is how has film music, we've kind of talked about this a little on the show one time, like we called you on the show, Deb, but I noticed just as a layman, as a dumb guy who watches movies, that scores don't grab you anymore. For instance, I'm going to use an example because I just watched it recently, Iron Man. Which is a great film. Weak ass soundtrack. And it's got some like a rock guitar twangs in there. I think it's just horrible. And I mean, the movie's not bad, but it could have been so much better with a better strong score. You know what I mean?
Well, when film first started, you would have a guy at a piano in front of a silent film, and he would just make it up as he went along. That's how Dmitri Tiomkin got started in film. He played in a Nickelodeon on a piano, and they would project it on the screen, and if a woman's being choked, he would make the sounds, you know, while he was playing the piano. And then when you go through the MGM era, they would try to work a lot of musicals, put songs in there.
Right.
In 1952, when a little film by Stanley Kramer called High Noon was being made, Dmitri Tiomkin wrote a song called Do Not Forsake Me. And he got his friend Tex Ritter to sing it. And the film was going to be put on the shelf. So they released it as a single, and Frankie Lane sang the song. It was a huge hit. Then then the studio said, hey, why don't we take advantage of the fact that this song is a hit and we'll release the movie? So they, Dmitri Tiomkin took pieces of the song along with his score, put it in the film, and it was a huge hit. So Hollywood sat up and took notice. Hey, music can make a film we weren't even going to release successful. So that was a two-edged sword. Yeah. Then you had the era of the title song. Every film, whether it was appropriate or not, had to have a title song.
Yeah.
And that went to silly extremes.
In the 70s.
Mainly the 50s, Love is a Many Splendored Thing, you know, Moon River, okay. Everything. Had to have a title. River.
Does Paint Your Wagon count? Or?
that was a musical to begin with.
Oh, okay.
And then when Easy Rider came along, it went the opposite direction. Easy Rider and The Graduate, where you would just have rock songs, pop songs.
Right. Or like American Graffiti.
Yeah. So suddenly they didn't want orchestral sounds. That was yesterday. That was nothing. So they would just start putting pop songs in there. The orchestral score was dead until Star Wars, and George Lucas said to John Williams, who had kind of been a Hollywood hack since the early 60s. Williams started out as a Mancini kind of wannabe.
Right, okay.
And George Lucas said, I want you to do a score like Eric Wolfgang Korngold's King's Row. So if you ever play the main title of King's Row by Korngold and the main title of Star Wars, most people can't tell the difference between the two.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's really close. But because of the Lucas paid very close attention to the way sound was presented in the theater with his THX sound, the presentation of the music with the visuals just knocked everybody on their butt.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, orchestral score became the thing again. You had to have orchestral score.
Another thing Star Wars brought us.
Another reason not to hate George Lucas like everyone does still.
Yeah, George Lucas is kind of like Gates, Bill Gates, the guy you love to hate.
Yeah. But you have to appreciate him for what he's brought us.
Yeah. And then the trend came where modern filmmakers, independents, they didn't want the music to be more important than themselves as a director or a filmmaker. So there is now a standing order in Hollywood and television. No recognizable melody.
Now, why is that?
They don't want anybody talking about the music.
Well, when did that happen? When did they decide that we don't need this?
A guy named Berman, who was connected with, I think, the Star Trek generation, the Next Generation. Yeah, yeah. He gave the standing order. He says, we do not want melody. If I recognize a tune in here, you're fired.
Oh, on the show?
Yeah.
Like just tones?
Yeah.
Kind of like on all the CSIs.
And they do that on Battlestar Galactica, all of them. They just want a kind of an organic churning. Music is almost like a sound effect. Yeah.
Well, at least that I know it's like tones and stuff, but you could tell like someone like Bear McCreary, he uses the tools that they make him use, and he makes it interesting at least, right?
Yeah, I've read interviews with him where he said he would love... He had written a great theme for Battlestar Galactica, which, if you recall, the original TV series had a magnificent theme by Stu Phillips.
Yeah, the only thing I've ever heard of Stu Phillips about.
Stu Phillips, he's kind of a second-string Hollywood composer. I mean, he's really good at what he does. But that theme was marvelous.
And instead, they used the Wailing Woman theme. Wasn't that Richard Gibbs or something that did the theme?
I think Bear McCreary was still connected with that.
McCreary was kind of an assistant on the miniseries. Remember, that's how BSG started.
Right.
Was that they had that miniseries. And then he left. That guy left, and I don't remember his name.
Richard
and then
Gibbs.
Bear, yeah, and then Bear took over as it moved to series. Now, see, I really, really like Barry McCreary's work. He's like one of the one composers like right now that I'm into. I even like his Terminator stuff that he's doing.
Yeah, but, he does the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Yeah, but at the same time, I understand absolutely what you're saying. It doesn't really have a noticeable theme. It has themes woven within for characters and whatnot, but it's not out and out. And a lot of time, it is, you know, I hate to say background music. It's music composed that accentuates the action on screen, as opposed to something that can live on the outside of what you're viewing. Now, one thing that I was thinking about while you were talking, Terry, was that, you know, there's two different words that we always trip on when it comes to talking about film music, and it's like one is soundtrack and one is score. It's kind of like the difference, I think, sometimes between the words movie and film. And I always use the word score and not soundtrack if I'm talking about, you know, film music, you know, because it's like back when, you know, I guess in the 80s and whatnot, like what you were saying, the film soundtrack was everything, you know. And you remember we got things like Top Gun where you'd go out and say, oh, I want to pick up that I forgot the composer's name.
Had a composer?
Harold Faltermeyer. Harold Faltermeyer was kind like of the Beverly electronic guy.
Oh, yeah, between. You're right.
Remember, he did Beverly Hills Cop.
As Top Gun starts, it has that score.
And I liked the synth soundtrack. It was kind of like, you know, post-Tangerine Dream. And it was like, you couldn't go out and find that music. They maybe would have one cut on the album. And you'd be like, what is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you remember when Batman... the soundtrack was first released. It was Prince released. It.
Right, the whole thing. And I'm like, where's the hell of the theme?
No Elfman score at all. Everybody who first thought they were buying the Batman
Everyone
soundtrack.
Everyone bought the Prince soundtrack on accident.
It was promotion.
I know. And that was so weird. And, you know, till where it became kind of a common thing now that you see two scores released, usually on big films, because these silly soundtracks... And I remember buying soundtrack CDs for one cut. You know, I mean, I know you obviously, Terry, you own the Golden Child score, am I right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for one cut. You know, for one, that one rejected song
that's
that got
right.
kicked out
yeah.
of Golden Child.
Best man in the world.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's beautiful.
I remember that.
So,
now.
But.
Yeah, Barry did the score to that. John Barry did. And then. Because Eddie Murphy had final say on everything to do with the movie, he wanted his guy. And so they threw out Barry's score, except for the song, and had another guy come in and just write a new score. So that started happening a lot in the 70s, and a lot of people who were top-notch composers, they either stopped composing in the U.S. and just went to Europe, or they pull way back on anything that they were
doing.
Was
it the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, Jerry Goldsmith was getting rejected scores. Ennio Morricone.
He was doing every Joe Dante movie, though, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, here's a good example. The Scarlet Letter. Okay, Elmer Bernstein did the score. They threw it out. Ennio Morricone did the score. They threw it out. They had 2 weeks left, and Demi Moore... called John Barry and said, could you please help us? We've got to have a score. So John Barry is a very, very fast writer, and so he ended up doing the score. They probably would have thrown that out, too, if they had more time. But but it's the last thing they do on a film, and if you have a film that doesn't work, they always think they can save it by the music.
Right.
So you end up being like an emergency medical team.
Because there's some movies that you always heard that, like, say, I remember Young Guns. The first trailer I ever saw for Young Guns said, soundtrack by James Horner. And then when it came out, I don't remember who did it.
Alan Silvestri did it.
No, it was an electronic type score. I'm talking about the first Young Guns. The second one, Alan Silvestri did. But the first one... It, James Horner's name wasn't on it, and it was like, I was like, who the hell is that dude? And it was like, it sounded like Nintendo music or something. And I always wondered, what happened to James Horner's score? And then years later, you read that the director thought it was too ethnic sounding. It's a Western. It shouldn't sound like it's Irish or something. And who knows? James Horner probably wrote it for another movie anyway, but that since Young Guns, I'm sure he used that same music he wrote something else. But
you know, there's this whole market now for alternative scores that don't exist. Well, you remember, it's like, it was sought after for a long time was the Jerry Goldsmith version of Legend.
Oh, yeah. Well, on the latest DVD release, they have the Tangerine Dream version and the Jerry Goldsmith version. Mm-hmm. And Ridley Scott even says in his commentary that he believes that Jerry Goldsmith really brought things out in the scene that Tangerine Dream didn't do. But Ridley Scott is famous for making bad music decisions for himself.
Right. Now, let's talk about like different opinions of different composers. And the first name that pops to my mind is Vangelis or Vangelis.
Yeah, he's a guy that he sits down at his synthesizer. They screen it for him. He makes it up on the spot.
Mm-hmm. I can do that.
he has a lot of really good instincts, though.
You know what? Blade Runner was one of my most favorite scores when I was young. I remember, and really, it was all about environment. It's about, you know, it's not so much that it was theme. It was that you could sit down and I used to put it on to fall asleep to.
And actually, the main theme you don't hear until the credits.
Yeah,
but Chariots of Fire, everybody knows that.
Yep.
Oh, sure.
It's basically a piano score.
Mm-hmm.
Chariots of Fire. Slow motion piano score. I remember when I saw the film Chariots of Fire, I was just disturbed that you had a contemporary instrument playing over 1920s film. I mean, I couldn't get beyond that.
That's the same thing for Tangerine Dream doing this kind of fantasy movie in a way. I don't know.
Well, with Tangerine Dream, and this started a trend, by the way, is instead of having to pay for your composer and for the orchestra and recording sessions and all the union fees that you pay, they could pay one guy. He does it all on his little machine. And that's the trend now. Mm-hmm. If you can get a person who owns a...
Harold Faltermeyer, I'm sure, bought a condo that way.
Yeah. I'll tell you, remember Midnight Express?
Yeah,
that won the Academy Award for this.
Oh, I love that song. I remember playing basketball to that song because they ended up using it as a sports highlight reel song.
Giorgio Moroder.
For years,
I would dribble my basketball around and be going dun 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 dun.
And it's like about smuggling drugs into Turkey. What are you doing?
Well, here's the thing about music: is any image with music behind it is helped. Almost any music at all. You look at The Third Man. Anton Karas did the whole score on a zither. And it works like dynamite.
Is that like a kazoo?
A zither is like if you pull the insides of the piano out, you just had the strings, and you took a pick to it.
Oh, okay. Kind of like a harp?
Ka-ding, ka-ding, ka-ding.
A kazoo. Ka-ding,
ka-ding, ka-ding. I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's an example how almost nothing except a theme can carry a film.
Right.
Really, melody in film.
So something like Iron Man, which I'm going back to, I'm sorry, when I watch the movie... It makes me angry because I know it could have been that much better. I even said this. I had a theory. Take the Black Sabbath song, Iron Man, turn that into an orchestral score. That bomb, 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 bomb. You know, it might have been cheesy, but still, it would have been cool, wouldn't it?
Well, if you look at Iron Man and you put it next to the 300,
mm-hmm.
they're basically doing the same thing. They're trying to get that.
The score to 300?
Yeah, the score to 300.
Who did that?
I don't have a clue.
Brian Tyler.
Yeah, Brian Tyler. He's a guy who you see.
It was that intense heavy metal sound, an industrial heavy metal, you know, heavy on the beat. It's not really music so much as it's an atmosphere.
But then, like, when you see something like that, and then you go back to Basil Poledouris, like Conan, you're like,
oh my God, one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, if you could just have something like that.
But this is generational.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When you were born, when you started watching films and falling in love with it, set your tastes.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
You got kids coming in who, you know, their only exposure to orchestral music is video
games. I find it hard to believe, though, if you're 10 years old watching movies now, you get excited over the score to 300 or Iron Man.
Yeah, people do.
Like, somebody watches Iron Man, like, I really love this rockin', this, you know, kind of.
Well, the other day in the store where I work, You Only Live Twice came on, and one of the young people that work there says, "Turn off that easy listening crap."
Oh,
and I thought, this is gorgeous
sacrilege.
Music. Did you pull like a machete? Shing!
No, I went into an objective mode. You know, I was thinking, okay, to them,
easy listening. This does not compute.
Well, to them, violins is wuss.
Oh,
right? It has to have a guitar
now. Does this come into action a lot, what they call good old day syndrome?
Yeah, sure.
When you're watching a movie like, well, in my day, they had melodies in movies.
Absolutely.
We're crotchety old men now.
Yeah.
Well, for example, if you ever get a chance, just listen to Moon River. It's so gentle. It's so wonderful and wistful.
Easy listening.
You play that for someone under 20... they're going to hold their nose and run out of the room.
Right.
They cannot absorb it. They can't relate.
Because I even remember seeing that. What was the movie that was with? Seeing as a kid with the cat. Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that and getting all choked up as a kid because of that song.
It's
and
wonderful.
You can even look at they used it again in Born on the 4th of July, which has an incredible score.
Yeah, John Williams.
It's even touching when they moved it into that film. You know, and it's I mean, it's just powerful. You see, with these scores today, like Iron Man again, it's just background music to accentuate the action, and it has no life of its own. And I think that's how these composers have been stripped, because, you know, if you go back and you listen to your scores that you've collected over the years, they have a life, you know. And it's like, I always know that I gravitate towards certain cuts on a score soundtrack. Like, let's go to The Mission, which is, you know, one of my most favorites. But it's got that, you know, it's like you can listen to the score of The Mission, and, you know, you can almost fall asleep, and it's beautiful. And then all of a sudden you get that wood instrument that, and you're like, oh, my God, and you wake up, and, you know, you have to – so I just have to reshuffle the songs.
Was
but,
that Maurice Jarre?
No, Ennio Morricone.
Ennio Morricone.
Okay. Morricone. But it's like – you know, that's the difference. I think that's a good score that it shows. It's like most today, it's all that action-accentuated music.
And what's wrong with the score grabbing you in a movie?
They don't want you talking about the music.
The last movie, honestly, that this happened, that or a score grabbed me, was The Forbidden Kingdom, the Jackie Chan Jet Li movie. I was like, this soundtrack rocks, man. I'm loving this.
I liked it.
Who did that, Andy?
I would have to look it up. Let me pull it up here.
David
he was another one who's come from the long line of the Hans Zimmer people. It was like Hans Zimmer to Harry Gregson Williams to this guy, and there's like a whole
Klaus Badelt.
Yeah, Media Ventures was the name of Zimmer's company, and his idea was, since film composers don't have any place to go to learn, they would come to work at Media Ventures, and it would be a school and a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And you would produce people who would go out and actually score films, because they'd become proteges. You take a Morricone, he had been a protege of a pretty famous Italian composer at the time, the guy who did Barabbas, 1 million years B.C., and he worked with a guy who was really experimental, and that's how he got his start. And Mario Nascimbene was the name of
Bene. Give me some Italian pizza,
so
please.
That's what Zimmer was doing with Media Ventures. The only problem is everybody sounded like Zimmer when they came out of that school.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was kind of shocked.
John Powell, too.
The Forbidden Kingdom guy sounds – I'm sure you could listen to it and say, well, here's what I hear, his influences – hopefully it's not derivative of those influences. It sounds unique, but like inspired by, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it actually grabbed me. Now, Hans Zimmer, I think, like Gladiator, really good.
Wonderful.
The pirate soundtrack has its moments, but it sounds very over and over again. Dun 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 bum.
with Zimmer, I remember when I heard the Rain Man score. When I saw Rain, I went back to that movie like 6 times, and mm-hmm. I went as far, because there was no soundtrack that came out immediately when the film was released, and this was when I was in college. I took a little handheld tape recorder and held it up to the screen.
Yes.
Yeah. I loved the Rain Man music so much, and still, it what they finally put out on a CD was only small cuts of it.
That's right.
Yeah. Of the score, and I was absolutely insane for that music. And I had like these years where I would like, Hans Zimmer, I'm going to the movie, and it's like I even bought the score for Driving Miss Daisy, which I've gotten rid of because it only works in context with the film mainly, but. I'm not so much that much on him anymore. I love what he's done with Dark Knight Batman stuff, although it's very different than what he had done earlier. But, oh my God, for a few years there, I was like Hans Zimmer bananas.
My first encounter with Zimmer was with Backdraft. I had never heard horns sound so monumental. That score just was powerful. And I thought, who the heck is this guy?
Yeah.
So what he had done is he did what Jerry Goldsmith had learned to do, where you supplement an acoustic orchestra with synthesizer patches. You would overlay one on top of the other, and All you right. record them at the same time. You have amplifiers in the studio, and you have the guy playing the synth, and what it does is it fills in the timbre with the acoustic instruments. Another good example of that is like in The Lion in Winter, another John Barry score in the main title, where you have the ground bass pattern that boom, 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 boom. He has a Moog synthesizer underneath the bass notes on the piano. And when that was re-recorded years later by Silva House, they redid the whole score. They didn't know he used a Moog synthesizer underneath that. So they just have the kettle drum and the bass notes on the piano. And it just sounds almost like nothing. And you say, why does it sound so bad? And then you realize... is John Barry put the edge in the sound with the synthesized sound. So Barry and Goldsmith and Zimmer know how to turn a regular orchestral sound into something that has... there's a term that they use. It cuts through. Mm-hmm. It puts an edge on the sound that you're hearing.
Well, yeah. When you bring up Jerry Goldsmith and... I mean, there's these guys who for lack of a better term, I would consider gods, John Barry, Jerry Goldsmith, John Williams, some of these scores that these guys did, even Goldsmith at the end of his career, he did the score for Star Trek First Contact. And if you listen to the opening main credits of that thing, that's extremely thematic. I mean, it's like they finally let him, they said, well, you're good, Jerry Goldsmith, you go ahead and do what you do. And it's some of the most gorgeous music I ever heard. I told my wife, I said, if I die and go to heaven, this is what's going to be playing. Well, it's after you get past the main theme and you get to the... it's very French horn driven. But, James Horner, when I was young, was another person who was huge for me because, I mean, what's the name of the movie? I couldn't get enough
Aliens?
Of the score.
Red Heat. Commando. No.
Well, Cocoon, or God, what's the Brad Pitt movie I'm blanking on right now? The Bonanza movie.
The Bonanza movie.
Tell me what Brad Pitt is doing in this film.
Well, he's got the long hair, and he's the brother, and there's three brothers. And it's like
Legends of the Fall.
Yeah, Legends of the Fall.
Oh, absolutely. Now I get the Bonanza reference because they're brothers.
Wonderful movie. Absolutely wonderful movie.
The score is just so immaculate to that thing. Very thematic, and that's what we've lost, you know. But, you know, there's these certain names, and it's like when I – it's like that's where my love of score becomes huge. John Barry, you know – I know we've talked about him a little bit, but really my love with John Barry didn't start with Bond. I learned the Bond later because I came to the Bond game very late. But, you know, it was Out of Africa. Mm. It was I think the first one was Somewhere in Time. We played Somewhere in Time, well, or the Paganini theme, which I know isn't Barry. We had that my wife walked down the aisle to that song, but we also played like music from Dances with Wolves in our wedding, you know, like at the very beginning and stuff like that.
That's funny. I got married to John Barry's We Have All the Time in the World.
Oh, that's awesome. On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Right. Yeah, but I mean, it's highlighted these moments of your life, and I know that I couldn't have listened to Out of Africa any more than I did. I mean, we just wore those cassette tapes thin, and it's weird now because, you know, I was always on the out because people would say, well, you know, I'm into Rush. What are you into? I'm like, well, John Barry. Yeah. You know what I mean? Jerry Goldsmith, John Williams, and be like, what the hell?
Well, I saw an interview with Sidney Pollack, and he said that. He had made the film, and he was trying different. What they do, what's called a temp track. It's where you have your film, you haven't hired your composer, you're trying to figure out what kind of music you want. And he tried all these different sorts of scores, and he ended up putting John Barry themes like Mary Queen of Scots and things like that. So he called him in, and he showed the film to him, and he says, "If I don't have a great score, this movie is going to die." And Barry said, "Okay, it's a movie. It's not about Africa. It's just a personal story.
Right.
Since you have to make it personal to these two people." Says, "All right, I'm turning it over to you." And of course, it's an Academy Award winner. Same thing with Kevin Costner with Dances with Wolves. Costner wanted a traditional film score, kind of like How the West Was Won. And, and John Barry says, it's not that kind of movie, Kevin. I mean, he's telling the guy who's making the movie, it's not that kind of film. It's not about the landscape. It's about
that movie would be totally different without that score.
Oh,
absolutely.
Totally
different.
And here's a good example of how much better John Barry knew than the guy who was directing the film. He said, "Make it strictly from the standpoint of your central character. You make it from that standpoint." So Costner, you know, made all these concessions and went along with Barry. Of course, it won the Academy Award and all that. Then from that point on, Costner hired James Newton Howard, who wrote good scores, but the scores were interior. They weren't external to the character. They're interior scores. And name one Costner movie since Dances with Wolves that has had that same kind of impact on audiences.
Yeah, none.
Yeah, he did that good Western, but...
he had Wyatt Earp.
Yeah, well, that was...
Look at the score. Look at the score to Wyatt Earp. There's nothing wrong with the movie.
The problem with the Wyatt Earp score is the theme is too much in the movie.
Oh, well, you know what's really funny is that I remember seeing the trailer for Wyatt Earp, and they were trying to sell you on a same type of vibe that was in Dances with Wolves, and what the music that they pulled was Ennio Morricone's score from, I forgot the name of the movie, with William Hurt. And I just recently found that soundtrack online. I couldn't believe it. I lost my mind. I was so excited.
Eyewitness.
And I'd have to. My recall is so bad.
Altered States. Eyewitness. Accidental. Tourist.
It was like a time of destiny. A time of destiny. That was the name of it.
Okay. Yeah.
And what the hell is that?
And it's It's a beautiful score. It's very reminiscent of The Mission and that kind of, when Morricone was in that, you know, that Untouchables phase.
Yeah.
Which Untouchables is another one that I just am crazy for. So they use that music in the trailer, and you can go look at this on YouTube, and it makes the movie look sweeping and beautiful and very Dances with Wolves. Yeah. And then you watch the film and you're like, we lost that. You know?
Yeah, the problem was James Newton Howard did what Kevin Costner told him to do.
Right.
And John Barry is legendary for telling the director exactly what he thinks and not doing what the director tells him to do. He said he's only followed the director's instructions once, and he was so ashamed of himself afterwards that he swore he'd never do it again.
What movie was it?
It was Mr. Moses.
What the hell is that?
Well, he had done Zulu.
Yeah, it was Zulu.
And Zulu is a fantastic score. Oh, and in Zulu.
Have you ever heard that, Andy?
You know, I've heard snippets of it, but I haven't heard. I think I've got some cuts on some of the compilation CDs.
It's almost a 3-hour film. He only had 18 minutes of music.
Oh, my God.
He kept telling Stanley Baker, who was producing the movie, he says, no, you need less music. He says, no, this is a big sweeping thing. He says, Stanley, it's the law of inverse proportion. The less you use the music, the more important it is when it comes in. And so he talked him into only using 18 minutes of score, but you would swear it's wall-to-wall music when you see the film.
Oh, that's interesting, because there's so many movies now where the music never stops, it seems
that's
like.
That's right. And you grow deaf to it. It doesn't have, you know, it doesn't get you.
It doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, there's a term they call spotting, where the composer sits down with the director, they spot the film and decide, usually the director will say, okay, I need music here. And a professional composer would say, no, you don't. If you watch Goldsmith's films that aren't action-adventure films, he hardly ever puts music in a scene where you would expect there to be music. But it'll come in subliminally. John Barry has this technique where he'll usually start with just a flute. A flute will creep in, and then the strings will come in under it, then the horns. It just sneaks in on you subliminally, and then it kind of rises. It's like water filling up a tank. It comes up into consciousness. There you go. Whereas people who have seen their film on the moviola, you know, the editing thing, over and over and over, they've lost that visceral reaction to it. So they keep wanting to put more stuff into it.
Right.
And that's why you get these bang, bang, bang movie scores. Is they've looked at that piece of film so many times, they're not feeling anything. So they keep putting more music, louder music.
What's an example of like a bang, bang, bang movie score?
You nailed it with Iron Man. I mean,
what was that
really...
pirate film? It was the last film that Rennie Harlan... Cutthroat Island. That is the worst example of a bang, bang, bang score.
Who did that?
John. Here, I'll look it up. Cutthroat Island.
The same guy.
That's actually
John Debney?
That's actually a good score. Yeah, John Debney. That's an interesting, nice score on its own. It very much overdrives that
baseball
film.
Bat. And then they drive spikes in the baseball bat. It's not good enough. They're beating you in the head. Now they want you to bleed and have puncture.
Now we're gonna break your legs.
But Rennie Harlan, you know, he just.
Rennie Harlan sucks.
He adrenalined out.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Well, if you look at Die Hard, for example, which is a film that changed Hollywood, by the way.
Michael Kamen.
Michael Kamen's score is really very subtle.
Yeah, it is.
Look at the score. It's very subtle.
Those little teen, ta, teen, ta, teen. Remember those little... Oh, yeah.
It's perfect.
And
really.
Beethoven's Ninth.
Mm-hmm.
And then Finlandia in the next film. But
I always let his soundtrack to Highlander.
Beautiful.
I tell you what, if you watch that film now, it stands up. And the sound mix on it, the 5.1 sound mix, is incredible. What he did with that is just a master. First time I heard Michael Kamen's score was the first movie he did. It was a Sean Connery movie. It was called The Next Man. I couldn't believe they even put an album out on it. I listened to that album over and over. I said, this is my new guy.
Do you recommend this for Andy?
Oh, yeah. You've got to see The Next Man.
Michael Kamen. Oh, I love, always loved. I even loved his Lethal Weapon stuff.
Iconic. Him and who's the guitarist?
Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton.
David Sanborn.
Yeah.
We kind of make fun of it now because it was like a parody of itself by the fourth movie.
Well, it was so popular that they just wanted more.
We need more. David, do another sax solo here.
You know. Self-indulgent.
Yeah, it's self-indulgent. It was derivative of itself by the time it got to the fourth movie. Michael Kamen, who's no longer with us, by the way, which is sad because he was young, wasn't he?
He was, and Basil Poladouris, we lost him too.
That was heartbreaking.
The theme to Band of Brothers by Michael Kamen, I just love
it.
It's such an incredible, it's just the opening titles to a show. And it's like the one show, like, you watch it on DVD. I don't know about you, Andy, but sometimes you skip over the main titles. Okay, let's get to the
never,
show.
Yeah,
never that's that show. You have ever. To sit through the whole thing, and every time it moves you with the images. It's like a perfect main theme to a miniseries.
Well, I grew up in the 50s, and every TV show had a recognizable theme.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I'm watching right now the box set of Have Gun, Will Travel. And you had Bernard Herrmann's bum, 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 bum. Bum, bum, bum. And I just realized watching it as an adult, that's a waltz. That's one, two. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. I'm thinking, oh, waltz? For a bounty hunter like a killer? But it's just genius, and it just identified that so well. But
there's a lot of those old themes. They had such intricate main themes, like the Perry Mason theme. Like, I'll put together old themes for the intros to the show a lot of time, and I'll listen to, like, the theme to Mannix or Perry Mason. I'm like, man, this stuff had meat to it.
It was terrific stuff, and you knew in the first 2 seconds what was coming on.
Oh yeah, just I love that dun dun dun, you know, dun dun dun, you know.
Fred Steiner.
Yeah, I didn't even know who did that.
I got to meet Fred Steiner.
Really?
1977, same night that I met Nicholas Roja and John Barry.
Wow!
But Fred Steiner was connected with the original Star Trek. He did the Star Trek theme.
Wow! So what happens there? You meet Nicholas Roja and John Barry in the same night. Who do you remember meeting? You know,
that night is so hyper real in my consciousness. It's like adrenaline. Every cell in my body was electrified with adrenaline. I mean, my hero.
You just met John Barry, and it's like, oh, Terry, Miklos Roja. Like, oh, yeah, cool.
And like, holy shit.
It was it was probably the peak moment in my life.
Wow. And that's what's so cool is that picture's in that book.
Yes.
In the John Barry
book. Forever frozen. Frozen in time.
Oh, yeah, we didn't talk about that on this show, but there's a book called John Barry, The Man with the Midas Touch.
The book has just come out. It's actually more than a biography. It's the entire career of John Barry from start to finish with thousands of photographs. He's kind of a private man. I remember when I was his biggest fan in the 60s, I couldn't find out anything about him. Mm-hmm. I mean, you didn't see articles. You never saw him on TV being interviewed. There was nothing, and it was on purpose. If it hadn't been for the Beatles, I think John Barry and the James Bond music would have been the most important cultural thing happening. But so many confluences were taking place in the 60s that they all were kind of competing with each other.
Right.
But this book, John Barry, The Man with the Midas Touch, it just came out, and if you look on Amazon, it'll say they're out of stock. Well, all they're saying is it costs $20. The book is so big and heavy. It costs $20 just to ship it from Great Britain. But if you do a Google search, you can go on. There's a Barry website, and you can order it direct from them and get it.
Nice.
But anyway, the night that I got my photograph taken, the photograph that's in the book, there was a film music seminar that was put together at the Writers Guild Theater in Beverly Hills. And that particular night, you had Miklos Rocha, who's a golden age guy. Mm-hmm. You had...
Name a score he did real quick.
Miklos Rocha? Mm-hmm. Oh, Ben-Hur, King of Kings.
Yeah. I've heard of that.
Yeah. King of
Huge.
Kings. Just so many. My mind blanks. He was such a cultured man. He was very unassuming and modest. And I remember I handed him an album to sign. And on the front cover, it was from Lust for Life, the movie that he did. Kirk Douglas played Van Gogh.
Right.
On the cover was a Van Gogh painting. Now, I'm handing him these albums. I had five of his. And he's signing on the cover, Miklos Rocha. I hand him the cover with the Van Gogh painting. He stops, he turns it over on the back and signs it. And I thought, that was weird. And then I realized, he's an art collector. He would not dare sign his name over another artist's work.
Nice.
It was just that cultured realization.
Yeah.
You know, that you're dealing with a guy who's just a Renaissance man. But that night, they would show clips from their films and show how music was in it. And then they would go up on the platform, they would just take questions from the audience. So it was quite a night, but Fred Steiner was there. Fred Steiner and David Raxon.
Is he related to Max Steiner?
No.
Okay.
He wasn't related to him,
Steiner.
Max Steiner.
Steiner.
But he was connected to so many themes. But the Peter Gunn theme and the Star Trek theme were his.
God, Peter Gunn just, it doesn't ever die, that theme.
Peter Gunn, Henry Mancini.
The Art of Noise tried to make it go away, but...
Henry Mancini tells about when he got out of the Army, he used to go to the movie studio to get a free haircut. He would just sneak in the movie studio. And one day he wanted a haircut, so he went in there and he runs into a friend of his he knew from the Army, Blake Edwards. Hi, Blake. Hi.
Wow.
What you doing?
Boy, that changed his life.
I'm working on a TV series about a private eye. Oh, what are you doing, Henry? Well, I'm kind of out of work right now.
Wow.
You're still a musician? Yeah. Hey, would you like to do some music for this thing for me? And so he said, Henry Mancini says, if I hadn't have gone for that haircut, you may never have heard of me.
Wow.
And they had no budget. He says, I can afford maybe five instruments. You know,
wow. So Peter Gunn and then Pink Panther. My God.
Pink Panther.
Mr.
Lucky
happened.
And, talking about the Breakfast at Tiffany's. And it just... Dear Heart, he had hit after hit.
When you think about it, yeah, it's just like if someone were to say Henry Mancini, but if you hum Peter Gunn or Pink Panther, they know his music.
Oh, I mean, he died of cancer, but I mean, his music is going to be eternal.
Yeah. Right now, there's a commercial with the Peter Gunn theme on it. It'll never go away.
Well, it's such a strong thematic thing. Like the James Bond theme, it is iconic. I mean, right. It transcends anything that you put next to it. Like Andy was talking about the also Sprach Zarathustra that we immediately think of 2001. Mm-hmm. The Stanley Kubrick had hired Alex North, who had done Spartacus, a number of other films, to do the score. And he told Alex North, okay, the main title, I want something like this. And he gives him also Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss. So if you listen to the score that Alex North did, he's doing stuff that Kubrick wanted him to sound like this other stuff. So it's a score that ends up sounding like pastiche.
Yeah.
And you can see why Kubrick ultimately threw out Alex North's score and just used the needle dropping is what they call it, where you just use the...
Put the record on?
Yeah, put the record on.
Yeah, the temp score or whatever.
And so you can't help but think that in being so wrong,
but where did he get
right.
the... music from
Ligeti.
Like, how the hell do you make music like that?
That's exactly right. So he just used these ideas, musical ideas. So he had kind of an idea. When Kubrick approached Spielberg to do AI, he says, I only insist on one thing. When you're going into this city, or you're going into these women's mouths across this bridge, mm-hmm. he says, I want this particular piece playing. And so... that's what Spielberg did.
You know, and what piece was it?
It's some Strauss piece.
That music, some of the stuff, what does it say? Oh, well, I don't have the title of it. Some of that music at the end, oh my God, is so powerful. I love that score, that Williams score.
That film and that score do something to me that...
Oh yeah, me too.
And
a lot of people, hated it, but not me. I remember we watched that film, and I think a lot of it has AI. To do with the score with
that movie,
John Williams, and we watched it with my wife and my son Wesley when he was a little younger, and by the end of the movie we were all bawling our heads off and like holding each other, you know, because it was just so powerful. And I really think the power was not in the kind of sour, you know, sweet Spielberg, you know.
It wasn't John Williams' bread and butter type score.
It was John. Oh no! Well, that's one thing I love when John Williams does these offshoot scores.
It was more personal.
It's typical. That aren't his typical thing. Well, AI was that way.
I would almost say that it was a subdued score where I was watching the film, and the music affects you where you're not self-conscious to it.
Yeah. It's mastery of how music and film go together.
Oh, yeah. Right. But, I mean, he did – what was the other one he did? Oh, God. Well, with William Hurt and Gina Davis, a score he did.
The Accidental
Tourist.
I knew I'd get the Accidental Tourist in there.
That's a beautiful one, too. And I love when he did these little offshoot scores. It's like, well, that doesn't really sound like what you've always done.
You would
done,
think you'd have to.
My favorite
otherwise
one
you'd go crazy.
Of Williams, that's a throwaway to most people, is Stanley and Iris. Jane Fonda and Robert De Niro.
Oh, wow. I don't think I've ever seen that.
That score is just, it affects me every time I hear it.
Mm-hmm,
For me, I want to feel something that I don't ordinarily feel.
Do you feel that John Williams has gotten bored with the... I honestly feel that, like, say, Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, even though I love the Star Wars music, I felt like it was almost like, I've got them on CD, George, just kind of play those tracks from the last movie. It didn't feel like there was, like, newly written music. Now, listen, I'm just saying that it felt like there was music that was... from the Phantom Menace that
You're
was
hurting,
in the next
Andy.
Movie.
You're
no, well, no, all right, look, here's what I'll say. Attack of the Clones does have that nice scene that da na 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 na.
I
love
that. I hate that so much.
Oh, well, I love that. So
I
love the love theme,
look at it
if
this
you
way.
Will.
Look at it this way.
I loved it.
But it should have been a love theme written for those two people instead of like something grander. You know what I mean?
Let's say your wife asked you to build some intricate thing in the backyard, like a barbecue grill, and you had to lay each one of the bricks in, and it takes you a long time, and you finish it, and you think, oh, man, this is great, and I'm glad I did it. She says, I want you to build one for the neighbor now. And then when you get through with that, what you're doing is you're doing the same thing over and over and trying to bring something
right.
We were talking about the James Bond films earlier. If you look at the difference in the scores between From Russia with Love and Goldfinger. Now, Goldfinger and Thunderball are kind of similar but different, and then You Only Live Twice is a completely different milieu.
That's my favorite one, Only Live Twice.
But oh. Barry was tired of doing the same thing, so he kept changing the sound. He changed it and changed it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens to Williams and Goldsmith. If they can't find a new way that makes it interesting for them, because most composers will tell you that they hate doing action sequences because it's a lot of notes, it's a lot of writing, and it's a lot of sound, but there's very little interesting. If there's no melody and no thematic changes, it's not interesting for a composer. You're more like a workhorse. You're just
Basically, what I was trying to say about John Williams is he is going through the motions in a way that he did it for Phantom Menace. Phantom Menace, I think, is an incredible. You've got Duel of the Fates and all that, but it's
Anakin's
just
theme.
But it's just reused in the next movies, almost like. It didn't feel like original music written for Attack of the Clones, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, they made they made him do the series backward, if you stop and think about it. He had to do the ending first, then go back and do the beginning. But the ending's already done. So you, what he's really doing in those last three movies is he's laying the groundwork melodically and what they call motifs for what will happen later. But these are just, it's a seedbed, so it's not as obvious. It's not developed. So musically, he's being true to himself, but we're used to those strong themes.
Right. Okay. I know what you're saying.
So he's having to build the building backwards.
Okay.
And we're blaming him for it.
But no, I'm not blaming him for anything. I'm just saying that in Attack of the Clones, that romantic theme, Andy, I thought was played too many times in the movie. They kept going back to it.
Well, that was a sweeping thing. I think that's what George wanted to do, was he said,
I think it's over.
I want a big sweeping thing. Well, look at the relationship that it was highlighting.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you play this big, beautiful music over this retarded relationship, it kind of hurts it, you know? And I think that's tough, because I think that Phantom Menace is just, I can't tell you how many times I've listened to it just on its own, even if you just don't even think about Star Wars, you know? It's like, I never listen to the main theme. Whenever I listen to a Star Wars score, I skip track one.
Yes, exactly, because it's been heard too much.
Yeah, right. I don't want to hear the main theme, like, ever again.
Now stop and think about that. I do the same thing. I don't want to hear Star Wars anymore.
Right.
Now, why
but
is
I
that?
Wanna...
What about Indiana Jones? You ever want to hear that again?
I never liked Indiana Jones.
The score?
Yeah, never liked
it. I like parts of the score.
Never liked it.
I think Raiders... But it's not the main theme. It's like the basket game or the basket chase scene.
I love the truck chase music. That dun 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 dun.
Oh yeah, I know the score so well. It's like I know every little note.
I love the Temple of Doom score. That dun bum bum bum. You know that.
Yeah, I liked all three. I liked all three. The latest one though was an abomination. It was just. It sounded like, well, you know what? Remember when they hired the guy to come on and do the score for Superman 2?
Oh yes.
And John Williams didn't have anything to do with it.
I remember.
I asked one year. I asked for the Superman score for my birthday, and they gave me the Superman 2 score.
Who did that?
I don't even know. And it was just like, wow, what a pile of
Ken
steaming
Thorne.
Crap, you know? And it's
Ken
just like
Thorne.
Ken Thorne.
Ken Thorne.
Yeah.
He's a British
guy. And it was just like...
they didn't realize they were insulting you.
Yeah, it was like, let's hire someone to mimic. You know, I mean, really, that's kind of what David Arnold does to a certain extent. I mean, I think he's good at it. But it's like, let's mimic John Barry. And I think that anytime you get those sequels, you have someone to mimic somebody. But...
How'd you like to be Christopher Young doing the third Spider-Man? You know, it's like...
Well, the thing is, you can transform something if they let you.
Yeah. No, here's all the music written from the first two. Just use that.
I would hate to be, you know, the guy coming on to do the sequel. It was interesting to see how Hans Zimmer jumped on part two after there had been such a strong theme built for Pirates 1. You know, if you remember, the main theme from Pirates of the Caribbean is not a Hans Zimmer song. And he came on and did 2 and 3.
That's what I'm trying to remember. I don't remember who did the parts.
Yeah, I'd have to hold on. Let me pull it up
Danny
here.
Got all my...
Is that an overscored set of films, you think? There's too much music in those movies?
I didn't really like the films.
Really?
They were too big.
Too big?
It was like Transformers where they're trying to kill me with the film.
I love the second one. I think the second one's excellent.
Oh, man.
Whichever it's called.
Do you want to hurt me?
Dead Man's Chest. Dead Man's Chest. I think the third one, they crammed too much into it. But
yeah, there's too much.
I think it was very ambitious, and hell, they were very successful. But the second one I really like.
Klaus Badelt is the one who did the
original.
Yeah.
Klaus Badelt.
Klaus.
You know what? That's what. Okay, he did the first one. It's a big hit. Okay, we don't want you doppelganger anymore. We want the real guy now. We want Hans Zimmer. It's like, oh, but he taught me everything. No, we're going to have to show you the door. We got Hans Zimmer now.
Well, here's something we really haven't discussed is that Hollywood is a business now. Well, it has been for quite a while, but you have businessmen who are running studios and making decisions, and there's a lot of synergy, which means you have people under contract. You want them making money for you, so you'll plug them in. All right, let's get this guy's songs in it. It's what Sylvester Stallone did with Rocky, right? You know, he was getting his brother singing songs, putting him in here and this.
Take you back.
Yeah, take you back.
This is the end. Didn't he do a song like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's where everybody wants to get their friends and the people that work for them. And
these guys live downstairs from me. They're a band. You know, the best story about that is the guy who did Boondock Saints had a rock band. He's like, we're going to score the film, too.
Well, a good example of that working is Queen with Highlander.
Yeah.
They had him do totally one worked. Song. They loved what they did so much, and Queen loved the film so much, they kept writing stuff and sending it in to him. You might want this, too. So that was a good marriage between Michael Kamen's scoring and what Queen was doing.
They're the funnest part of Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Without that music, I mean, it's just silly.
Yeah. So. It's kind of silly anyway.
Yeah.
But they're the best part
silly.
Of the movie.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, sometimes talent will out. Mm-hmm. It trumps badness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You get enough talent.
That's what I'm saying. Like what I was saying about John Williams, like, say, with Indiana Jones. Do you think he had fun writing that score, the Crystal Skulls?
I think in the early days he did.
But, I mean, Crystal Skulls, do you think he was having fun doing that?
I think John Williams has moved on in his life. He's an old man now. He's done everything. Usually what happens with composers is they start doing private, personal music for themselves. Like John Barry, he writes personal music now. He's through with films. He can't stand dealing with the people he has to deal with. Jerry Goldsmith was the last wunderkind who was just going strong.
Oh, he was so prolific.
Oh, man.
Oh, I couldn't believe it. He'd be like, he did 5 films this year. It's like, are you kidding me?
But he would do, I remember he started using synthesizers and stuff with his music.
Yeah, his son Joel got into synthesizers. Joel Goldsmith.
I love the soundtrack. You know, I don't know how old I was, Dad, 12 or 13, but the soundtrack to Tom Selleck's Runaway, I thought was so cool.
That whole score, Jerry Goldsmith, that's him and his Yamaha, and he's playing all the parts.
Have you heard that, Andy?
I haven't heard that one. The one for Jerry Goldsmith with me when I first heard this synth was, do you remember the score that he did for, it was a Nick Nolte movie in Powers Booth, and they were kind of doing a Pat Garrett, Billy the Kid thing? I forget the name of the film.
Extreme Prejudice?
Yes, that's it. Yeah. I bought the LP. I found the LP somewhere. And and I remember hearing that score. And then, of course, it went into
Walter
Rambo.
Hill movie, I think.
First Blood.
Well, you know, Goldsmith started using electronics on TV, you know, early on. And then the first film I remember seeing it in was The Satan Bug. You ever see The Satan Bug?
No. Great title, though.
I'll tell you what. You watch that film, Satan Bug. He's got this little thing that goes, wonga, 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 wonga. Whenever they mention the Satan Bug, and there's a thing that goes, shh, while it's going, wonga, 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 wonga.
Thank you.
And it works like mad. You feel creepy.
The Satan bug.
Yeah, the Satan bug. The premise of it is that there's this secret place in Arizona run by the government where they're developing a virus to use for germ warfare. Someone steals it. And
it's the Satan bug.
Yeah.
Great title. I love it.
It's a good film. I mean,
Andy, you got to, I'm telling you, Runaway, Jerry Goldsmith.
I will. I'll pick it up if I can.
But Goldsmith, because his son was into synthesizers, like Maurice Jarre, his son, Michael Jarre, is into synthesizers. They got into it too. So Goldsmith said what he would do is he would sit down and he'd find a patch, which is a voice that's already on the synthesizer. He'd find a patch he liked, then he would work it into his score. He'd write for that sound. So by the time he really got masterful at it, all of his score, what's the one where if you're 30 years old, they're going to do
Logan's
away with
Run?
Logan's Run.
I love it.
That's a really good example of trying to do futuristic music where he would combine the outside world. Outside the dome is pure acoustic orchestra. Inside the dome, it's all futuristic synthesizers.
I even noticed, like, take something like Terminator, Brad Fidel. I don't know if he ever did anything else, but...
Yeah, Serpent in the Rainbow.
It works with Terminator. Maybe, is it because... No, that was Craig Safon.
Ah, right.
But the Terminator, I know it works with the Terminator film. And then when they did Terminator 3, which never exists in my brain.
It never existed.
It's been erased from my mind, but...
Well, it's also been erased in the TV series, if you remember. They skipped right over it.
Yeah. But who did that? They were like, we'll get an orchestral version of the Terminator soundtrack. It just didn't work.
No.
Because it's too ingrained in our brain. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, funny you should say that, because you take somebody like the director who gave us Halloween, John Carpenter.
Right.
Right.
And he can't afford a composer. So he gets together with his friend, Alan Howarth, who has a synthesizer, and he says, there's this thing I learned on bongos. It goes boom ta ta boom ta ta boom ba boom ba ba boom ba ba. He says, can we do something like that? It's kind of like he was thinking in his head, The Exorcist.
Really?
You know that little tinkly?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What's it called? A little theme that was played.
Creepy music, yeah.
So if they just did that, ding dong dong ding dong dong ding dong ding dong, and it's 5/4. It's a 5/4 thing, and it was a bongo exercise when he was taking bongo lessons.
Oh, tubular bells.
Tubular bells, yeah, Mike Oldfield. So he says, let's do kind of like a Mike Oldfield tubular bells thing, and we'll just use this 5/4 bongo exercise. And that's all he knew about music. But it works so well.
Yeah.
Oh, John Carpenter has got a special, special place for me with his scores. So, like you said, it's not an educated sound. But if anything, Carpenter, as a director, understood atmosphere. So always his favorite films of mine have been, it's like if Carpenter scored the film, boy, I was running to the movie theater. I was so excited.
He has a dramatic sense of what works.
Yes, yes. Well, like Escape from New York. I mean, it wouldn't work without his kind of corny score. But I love it. You know, it's wonderful. But it's so in line with the film. I don't know that he could necessarily go off and score someone else's film. I mean, he did to a certain extent with Halloween 3, but it was really just a reworking of his.
He
main
did Black
theme.
Moon Rising, and he just produced that. Have you ever heard that, yeah. Andy?
Tommy Lee Jones. Oh,
it's been so many years. That stuff is awesome.
How about They Live?
Yeah,
it's got kind of this blues guitar thing going on.
Bum, bum, bum. Maybe the whole score is three notes. Yeah. Bum, bum, bum. Ding. Bum, bum, bum.
What is it we love about that movie? Because the ending doesn't work to me, but it's something, every time it's on TV, I got to watch it.
The parts are greater than the whole.
Yeah.
There are little moments you wait for.
The chew bubble gum line.
Yeah.
The fight scene that goes on.
There you go. Put these glasses on. No. It's like, damn it, just let him put the damn glasses on. But there's those moments that were great. It's almost like if you go back in time and say, John, if we could just edit it down a little, get a stronger ending, this movie would have been fantastic, I think. You know? Well,
music.
But it is great the way it is, though.
I find that my favorite films, the ones I want to go back to, there are moments I wait for musically, where the music and the moment come together. There are many of them in Lawrence of Arabia, which is my favorite film. But my key moment in Lawrence of Arabia that still gives me chills to this day is after they've ambushed this train. The train goes off the tracks. All the Arabs, the Bedouin have come down, and they've stolen everything they can off the train. This guy tries to shoot Lawrence, and it hits him in the arm. And he says, "Are you hurt?" He says, "Not hurt at all." And he gets up on top the train because Jackson Bentley, the photographer, wants to take a picture of him. The sunlight is behind Lawrence. He's got those billowing robes, and everybody's going, "Lawrence! Lawrence! Lawrence!" And and the camera shows him on top of the train. He's just walking from railroad car to railroad car. And the music at that moment and the visuals come together, and I just get chill bumps to this day, even talking about it. Just a little moment like that. Mm-hmm. Key moments in films where you wait for the music, and the music comes together with the image, and that's the film for you.
This would be my example of that. Would be such a small moment in Star Wars, but when Luke steps outside on Tatooine and looks at the dual suns.
Yeah, two suns. Exactly. Yeah. That was the one I was going to say.
That's like that was the moment of Star Wars. That's the moment you always want to go back to.
There's moments like that in movies where I'll see it years later and I go, the chill is still there.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
You don't ever want it to go away, and you're almost waiting for it, and you feel that, it's still there, that effect. And that's what's great also when you rewatch a film that
I watched. It was another Sean Connery film, The Wind and the Lion. It was a Jerry Goldsmith score.
It's a fantastic film.
That film and the music and everything come together several times in there. Mm-hmm. It's just wonderful. But there's a scene to watch that has no music. It's where the Marines have been sent in by Roosevelt to basically shoot this guy who's giving him trouble. And I think it's in Morocco. And they come off the ship, and they're just it's this contingent of Marines, and they're running through the street in fast march step. Jump, 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 jump. And they've got their guns, and they're running through the street. Jump, 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 jump. Any other composer would have put music behind that, but just the sound.
Something like that.
He put nothing, and the scene works fantastically. So you're thinking, it's as much knowing when not to do anything as when to do something.
Alan Silvestri would have put tribal drums in that part.
the poor man's Tangerine Dream.
I'm always ragging on Alan Silvestri, but
there are composers you love to hate.
Yeah, it's based on the Abyss score, because I think the Abyss would have been so much better with a better score than the, you know, the weird like glass sounds.
I wasn't thinking Alan Silvestri. I'm sorry.
Oh, who are you thinking of?
Sylvester LeVay. I wasn't thinking Alan Silvestri. I like the Abyss. Shut up.
You know, Alan Silvestri was working as a rock guitarist in a lounge in Las Vegas, and a friend of his was passing through for the weekend with the guy's girlfriend, and Silvestri says, "What are you doing now?" He says, "I'm connected with this TV show. It's about motorcycle cops. It's called Chips. How about you, Alan?" He says, "Yeah, I'm stuck here." He says, "Hey, why don't you come out to Hollywood? Maybe I can get you a gig." You know, just kind of act like a big guy, big man. Wow. So Sylvester takes him up on it, shows up, says, "What you got for me?" And the guy says, "There might need a little music behind a scene up here. Let me talk to the producers." And so they said, "Okay, if you can come up with a scene." Silvestri couldn't write music. He could only play guitar. So he got a friend of his, and he says, what am I going to do? He says, you're dead in the water, man. And the friend that he met in Las Vegas calls up. He said, before they let you do this scene, can you set an example of some of the dramatic scoring you've done?
Oh, my God.
So Alan Silvestri cobbles together some Goldsmith cuts off an LP he's got, and he sends them the tape.
Oh.
And they love it. Hey, this guy's good.
Oh, no.
So they let him. And the episode that he scored was they were going to let Ponch do a disco thing. They were kind of capitalizing on Saturday Night Fever.
Wow.
So he comes up with a disco thing, and his friend has to write the music down, and they go in there. But that episode was a huge success because Ponch was kind of put forward as the big guy, and they got a lot of reaction to it. So
he's
they figured
sex symbol. Yeah.
They figured everything connected with it must be successful. So then they hired Alan Silvestri to do music for Chips. So it's basically Silvestri and his buddy doing the orchestration.
So without Ponch, think about this: you would never have the Predator music, or you wouldn't have the Back to the Future music.
And you know, my criticism of The Abyss, James Cameron probably asked him for that, but I own the score even, Andy. But I make fun of the fact that the knife fight scene has tribal. It's so like by the numbers, kind of like.
Here's the thing: Silvestri had no orchestral training. All he knew was rock and roll, so he had to think in terms of what he knew and try to spread it out and make it something that he didn't know.
He did Back to the Future is probably his most memorable score. Wouldn't
you
say?
Know, most of that is the orchestrations. Mm-hmm. Very little.
Ba, ba, ba.
He's good at themes, little themes, memorable, simple themes, like Forrest Gump.
His worst score where he should have been taken out and shot in the back of the head, and it's probably not his fault, again, it's probably the director asked for it, is The Quick and the Dead. His
Morricone tribute.
Yeah, what did you think of that, Andy? Seriously.
I don't even remember it, to be honest with you. I certainly don't own it. So
I remember thinking, why didn't they just use Morricone?
Why didn't they hire Ennio Morricone instead?
Well, it's like with Mission Impossible. You know, Lalo Schifrin's alive and kicking, still got a career. They're doing Mission Impossible. Why not hire Lalo Schifrin to do Mission Impossible?
Yeah, let's hire Limp Bizkit to do the theme.
They got Danny Elfman.
Yeah, Danny Elfman with the first one, and then I just remember Limp Bizkit did the bound, 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 bound. Yeah. It's like, yeah, that's real cool. Or
I thought you two do a version of that or something?
Who didn't?
Yeah, really.
it's iconic.
Did they do the third one?
The only thing I even like about any – well, I like the third film because it was Abrams, but the only thing I can even stand about one and two is Zimmer's – there's like one theme in the Zimmer score for – Mission Impossible 2 that I really liked, like Chimera theme or something. It's really pretty. But the rest of it, holy gosh.
Yeah, they don't even understand the theme they have. It works for what it is, and then they want to make it into something it isn't. Let's make it bigger. That's like saying, you have this beautiful woman in a swimsuit. Let's put about 100 pounds on her.
Yeah.
That'll make her more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
When you over-orchestrate something that's simple.
Or the word modernize. We need to modernize.
Yeah, there you go. That's what they do with the James Bond film.
Well, let me ask you this. I remember a while back there was a thread on the Hollywood Saloon forums, Andy, and it was about it was about the kind of the state of film scores now. Are they good or they're bad? And there was a lot of defenders. Well, actually, so-and-so is doing really good music.
All right.
I don't buy film scores anymore.
No,
I don't go to movies because someone's doing the, the score. I've just kind of, as the number one lover of film scores, I've become indifferent.
Is that what it is? Just kind of, there's nothing
that
grabs
you anymore? They're
not
doing what I love. So, when I go in to see a film, I just say, okay, whatever happens, happens.
When was the last time you saw a film that the score grabbed you? Has it been years and years? Or?
I did just see one. That's a tough one. Because it hardly ever
Did you see what Brian Tyler did on the new Rambo film? Because the theme at the very end of the new Rambo film, after they've wiped out the army, I think is gorgeous. And he doesn't mimic the Goldsmith. It's a whole different theme altogether. And that's one of my favorite things from this year.
I just saw Elizabeth the Golden Age. And I thought the score was fantastic with the film. And I'm sorry, I can't tell you who did it. When I looked up his name, I said, I don't know who this guy is. But it made me want to...
Isn't there a Tyler Bates, and then there's the other...
Brian Tyler?
I don't know.
Right, I get them mixed up sometimes. I think Brian Tyler did... I don't remember. I'll have to look up the Rambo.
One guy did Rambo, and the other guy did 300. Am I right? I don't know.
Right, and I mix them up sometimes. Let me see Rambo. I have it listed as Rambo 4. I don't have the name here.
You never saw the Rambo, did you?
I did.
Release Rambo.
I would like to.
Now you should listen. Brian Tyler did the Rambo, and he homages the Goldsmith very well, but at the same time he creates some new themes. So yeah, I would definitely suggest that to you. I'll send you a cut from it,
it's
Terry,
violent,
if you want.
Okay. Violent as hell movie.
Yeah, well, I would expect it to be. But here's where composers either rise or fall. Is you have one success. So somebody else is going to make a film like it. They want you to do the same thing you just did, exactly, except different.
Right.
When Morricone started out, he burst on the scene because of Fistful of Dollars. Okay.
Right.
Do you know how many Westerns he did before he said, I can't do this anymore? He did maybe 40 Westerns.
He gets mad. I read that he gets upset when people only remember him the old Western music, because he's, and we as, lovers of film music know that he's got so much more to him than just that. But most people only remember,
it's iconic, isn't it?
I think what's wonderful about those films is the music was allowed to be a character on screen.
It
wasn't the philosophy where if you notice the music, then it's wrong. You were waiting for it. You wanted that Jew's harp, or you wanted the
little
whistle.
Isn't that what's funny, though? Because I guess they're thinking layman, but you notice the music when it's bad, too.
Yes, you do.
So it does actually pull you out of it. It has the same... They think it's bad for you to notice the music if it's really good or calls attention to itself, but it also calls attention to itself if it's bad. Well, if it's not giving you what you need.
Here's something I'll never understand, is when filmmakers use the term manipulative, film to work has to manipulate you.
It has to.
For instance, like Quantum of Solace, the Mathis character, if he had a certain theme, maybe he did, I don't recognize
I don't
it,
know.
But when he has his scene...
Dying scene?
When he has his death scene, spoiler alert... Wouldn't that have been so much more powerful if he had certain theme? Yeah. But you guys know what I mean? Like, if there was
Norman
a Mathis
Bates
theme.
Is actually the killer. Oh, spoiler alert.
What if the whole point of Quantum of Solace was Vesper Lynn? What if Vesper Lynn had a... John Barry would have given her a distinct theme, wouldn't he?
The way he's always approached it is what he does in the main title is going to be the template for everything else that happens in the score.
Okay.
And he will take a little of this and develop it, a little of that. But the music's always saying something to you. It's like you can mouth the words to the song to something that's happening.
Well, I'm saying that, like, whenever James Bond is thinking of Vesper Lynn and Quantum of Solace, we might have gotten a theme that kind of made us feel that emotion we did when we saw her on the screen in the previous movie. But that was kind of lacking there, wasn't it?
Yeah, no leitmotifs allowed.
I remember nothing when I walked out, because I listened extremely much, bad word there, but I really listen intently to a James Bond score because it's important to me to know about these scores. And that one, there was nothing to it. I walked away with absolutely nothing. There was more, much more in Casino Royale than there was even in this film. I took nothing away from it music-wise.
Now, David, what we want you to do is don't do any music. Huh?
Yeah,
don't
exactly.
Compose anything. I think that would work best. Okay. You got to have the urgency kind of music.
I kind of have background information on this. And David Arnold was brought in. John Barry is the one who suggested him, because he had heard the album Shaken and Stirred, or Shaken Not Stirred, that David Arnold and a bunch of other people, he pulled together over a period of 5 years and had them do covers of a lot of John Barry's stuff. John Barry heard it. He loved it. He sent it to Barbara Broccoli, and he says, here's the guy that you need, because he was tired of them messing around with him, telling him what he needed to do. So if you're going to bring in somebody, I would suggest him. So David Arnold was brought in. And then they started telling him what they didn't want him to do.
Ridiculous.
And if you'll notice, the song he did, Surrender, is a real James Bond song from Tomorrow Never Dies. Mm-hmm. Sheryl Crow is not really a James Bond song. Surrender is the James Bond song, but they didn't use it. They wouldn't let him do it.
You mean you hear it throughout the movie in the theme?
If you hear it, you say, now this is a James Bond song. I mean, it follows the Barry format.
There's just too many cooks in the kitchen with James Bond.
When they tell you what you can't do, then you don't really know what you can do.
It's kind of, I mean, honestly, it's you almost felt like with Casino Royale, they finally wised up. But then when something succeeds, it's like, okay, let's start messing with it again.
Well, Barry's idea was, if you write the song correctly, then the melody...
What would he have said to the Quantum Solace song?
Well, the same way with Her Majesty's Secret Service. He knew there couldn't be a song that said, On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
That wouldn't have worked, would it?
Well, even with Thunderball, they said, what are we going to do with this?
Quantum of Solace! You know, something like that.
I remember they said that Tom Jones said, what does Thunderball mean?
Yeah.
He said, just think of it as Mac the Knife. You're singing about this sinister character.
Well, if you listen to the words, they mean nothing.
He always runs while others walk. He acts while other men just talk. Strikes like thunderbolt.
Yeah. They didn't tell you what a thunderbolt is.
Is he singing about the bad guy or about
just like thunderball?
What? Who the hell is thunderball?
An interesting sidelight to thunderball.
There should be a cameo with thunderball at the end.
John Barry wrote the song "Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang." That was the theme of the thunderball. Since they knew they couldn't write a song thunderball, he scored the film using "Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang." The producers got cold feet and said, "We always have a title song. You need one." So then Don Black and he got together and they wrote this. Now, he's got a whole score with Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang thematically. So he went back and he scored it a second time. There are two scores in that film if you watch it. So he did twice as much work. And that's the interesting thing about watching that film is seeing it scored twice at the same time.
Wow.
Do you
think that's one thing that he did that I loved. Go to Living Daylights. Was that the last one that he did or not?
Yeah.
No. Was it?
Yeah, that was the last one.
Okay, Living Daylights.
Yeah.
And did you know there's like multiple themes going on there as well, because you know they had the Pretender song and they also had the Aha song.
Yeah.
But the Pretender song was in there almost more than the Aha theme was.
Well, he's got three songs in there. Where Is Everybody Gone?
Right.
Where's
Everybody Gone? Right. Yeah, dun, yeah. Dun, 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 dun. And then the pretty one, the Pretenders, that dun, 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 dun.
If there was a man.
Yeah. Do you think he didn't like the Aha song?
No, here's what happened is they said, all right, you're working with Aha. Huh?
Who the hell are they?
With Barry being the professional he is.
They're from Iceland.
He went to a concert.
Norway.
He went to an Aha concert and he listened to him. And they had already written the song. He says, here's the song. And they handed
it to him. It's on a cocktail napkin.
So he went away and he put different chords to it. He opened it up. He put the background. He rearranged it, just like he did with the Monty Norman's thing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He presented it back to him, and the first thing they said was, Paul Wachtar said, oh, it sounds like a James Bond song.
Doy.
It's John Barry, jackass.
So he transformed it into a James Bond song. And then he extracted the part that he put in there for the score. So the whole film fits together. The song, the score, everything is a piece.
As a James Bond film should, yeah. Damn
and
it.
You know, when you listen to that, there's some synthesizer in that, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Well, what he found out was after he had he'd scored the film, that the producer said, it doesn't sound contemporary. So he went in and he overlaid some rhythm tracks, which are synthesized, that cut through the mix to where it just didn't sound like orchestra.
All the kids are using keyboards these days.
So he did that, and then it kind of picked it up, cut through the mix, and he got that great sound.
So basically, there are many talented composers working in film that if they would just be allowed to do what they want to do.
Cast them like you cast an actor. Come in and say, all right, bring us something. Bring your best to it. I'm not going to say anything to you.
Maybe there will be another renaissance in film where this will happen.
Maybe.
J.J. Abrams lets Giacchino do what he wants, doesn't he?
Yeah, I'm not high on Giacchino because they're...
Do you think he sounds too similar
to
himself?
I can't find anything in his music that's interesting.
Oh, I think he's effective. That's why I like him.
Well, it's like
he at least is giving me a pulse.
David Arnold scored a Quantum of Solace. I sat there and I said, okay, this is effective because they're using it like sound effects.
Right.
Mm. Right? It's like if you pull the trigger on a gun and you hear bang, that's effective. All right. Do you need the orchestra to go bang? That's what they're doing now. It's flash bang wallop. It's a
dun, dun, dun.
I like Giacchino, but I find it hard to listen to his scores.
Yeah, I mean,
from the movie.
I think they work within the film really well, but
it's functional.
Rarely do I put on a score of his and listen to it as I'm working on the computer.
I like the roar, the march from Cloverfield.
Oh yeah,
I like that a lot. But when did you hear it?
In the credits.
Credits, so it's not really a part of the movie.
It's just like the James Bond theme now. It's in the credits.
Exactly.
Well, Dad, thank you for being on the show. I know you have to
run. Thank
you, sir. It's been great talking about film music. I'm the idiot in this conversation, basically. I was...
the everyman.
I was raised on this music coming from the living room my whole life.
That was your child abuse. Instead of alcoholic beating you were beaten over the ears with soundtracks.
I know lots of names to composers. I don't know what it means, but I know who they are for some reason. Sometimes you can play music and ask me who it is, and I know who it is, but I don't know how I know that.
It's like being brought up in the cult. You're brought up in the cult of soundtrackery.
In the cult of film music. But thank you for joining us, Dad, and maybe we'll do this again,
You. And I enjoyed talking with you, Andy, because I know you're a fellow.
Terry, absolutely. I love talking to you about this. You know it in and out. And it's just the love of the music. It's so wonderful. And, I think you understand, like a lot of people don't, that it's in your soul, and it's beyond just the film itself. And I think that's the thing, is that when you find someone else who understands that, it's great to talk about it.
It's the flavor in the recipe that makes the food worth eating.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. I'm hitting the door now.
All right.
Totally awesome to have your dad to talk to like that. He's the bomb when it comes to... I haven't had a good, meaty film score discussion like that in a long time. Now, one thing I wanted to say before we wrapped was that I wanted to talk about kind of like where music is today. And I'm a little more optimistic than your dad is.
Right.
in that I don't love music today in film as much as I did, you know, 10 years ago. I think there's scores that are legendary for me, you know, that are forever, you know, some of those Barry scores, some of the Williams scores, some of the James Horner stuff, you know, Goldsmith. I think today, though, you get people like Thomas Newman, whom I really like a lot.
Oh, yeah, me too.
He's one of those guys. It's like, if I see his name on a film, I'm going to see that film.
He's or Mr. at least Pixar now, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, I mean, well, I don't know. I don't always get excited about Randy Newman scores. His natural score is one of my favorite scores of all time.
That's his iconic score.
That's the one that I love. And it's like, you know, the Toy Story score is like, you know, it's cute and all that and it works with the film, but I don't know that I would listen to it.
But Thomas Newman's Shawshank Redemption, that's a one for me.
Oh, Shawshank Redemption, there's a number of them.
American Beauty.
Yeah, I mean, he's just got that particular sound. He did a score for Men Don't Leave, which is a movie that never got a soundtrack release, never got a DVD release even, but it's a beautiful score, and it was one of his early projects. So.
Oh, I love his score, his theme to 6 Feet Under. How great is that?
Oh, totally. It was fantastic. Yeah, and you can usually – so, you know, you've got those composers who – you don't even if you don't know that it's them and you hear the music, you can go, okay, well, hold on, I know who that is now.
Yeah,
you can say, well, I know that's Thomas Newman. Now, when you get to someone like Zimmer and then Harry Gregson Williams, it's like you're like going, okay, it's a little hard to tell who is who. But I think Harry Gregson Williams is really good as well. And I didn't really fall in love with him until Spy Game. If you listen to that Spy Game soundtrack. Now, a lot of it is noisy, like your dad was saying, a lot of background music. But I think you can even do that well.
Right.
There's so many composers that do it and it's just completely forgotten.
You know, he's now doing the Metal Gear game soundtracks.
Oh,
Harry
cool.
Gregson Williams. And he adapted the original theme from the Japanese guy who did the original Metal Gear theme. I forget his name. It's something like Tappy. Like, he goes by just one word. But Harry Gregson Williams adapted his theme for Metal Gear Sons of Liberty, and it sounds incredible. It's awesome.
And see, so, I mean, he's great. I love a lot of his work. I'm trying to think of other guys who I'm really excited about. Obviously, Bear McCreary, I totally love. Those Battlestar seasons 1 through 3 scores, just I've listened to those more than just about anything in the last few years. Really loved them. Again, not so thematic, but I think I just love the dun 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 tigga 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 dum. You know, I love all the drums. But there's also some stuff that's really pretty in there as well.
There's
some
one,
of the themes like
there's
Ross's
one,
theme and stuff
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, there's one theme and I would have to listen to the soundtrack to see what the name of it that goes throughout every Battlestar episode, and it's a very tender theme. It might be Rosalind's theme, I don't know, but it's one I love whenever I hear it.
Yeah, and there's some, and so I think it really, I love his work, and they just announced that this Terminator CD is coming out, I think the 19th or something like that of this month. So I'm going to snag that
as well.
There's
one really quiet theme in that show that I love whenever they play it.
Exactly. Well, you know, and at first I didn't like it because I wanted Brad Fidel. You know, I wanted dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
Yeah.
But
you get that in the scenes previously on Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Exactly. and instead he made it his own, and it's some really great stuff. I always think it's too low in the mix. I'm like, God, can you please turn that music up some? But it's really good stuff, and he has not let me down at all.
You know,
and I'm interested to see him move into film. I'd like to see him get into film. He's done some low budget horror films, but
it's got to happen eventually.
Oh, it will. It will. Because he's just that good. So I'm not totally miserable about the state of music scores. But, God, if I pull away one or two scores a year that I like, I'm excited at this point.
The guy who did Forbidden Kingdom.
It's David Buckley.
David
is his name.
Buckley. Okay. Because when I was sitting there watching Forbidden Kingdom and the main titles come up, I thought they were so much fun and so cool. I turned the movie louder and louder and louder. Loving the music, and then when it gets to the big climactic scene and the music and everything, I had that movie so freaking loud. That have you ever done this? You're watching a movie really loud and you pause it to go pee.
Oh, I know.
You come back and you unpause and you're like, holy crap, because your ears have adjusted.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause you're gradually turning up throughout the movie, but then your ears have adjusted and you come back and it's like, oh my God, it's like makes your head explode. You can't believe that you were listening to something that loud. But
there was actually some, I heard an interview with him somewhere online, because I put his name in, because after I saw the movie, I didn't see it in the theater, but after I saw it, I started frantically searching for the score. I'm like, okay, I have to have this score. And then I learned that there wasn't a score at that time.
Oh, see, I did the same thing to you. I said, Andy, you have to find me the score to this movie.
Right.
I must hear it.
And there wasn't one, but then luckily they finally came out with it. I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, wasn't it like an Amazon exclusive or something?
It was. Well, it was like they had a few titles for a while, but when we investigated more, I finally found it somewhere. And I hate to admit this, but the internet is such a rich, rich place on how to find score soundtrack music that you can't find anywhere else, because, you know, you go to a store and they just don't have anything, and you find so many things that are gone and out of print and are just never made it to any store. Or, you know, the dreaded thing, you ever go to a store and say, okay, I want the Forbidden Kingdom soundtrack. They go, well, sorry, we can order it. And you're like, oh, please, just stop with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I am not going to order it and come back in 2 weeks. I'm going to order it. I'm going to go home to Amazon.
Yeah.
But no, the internet is so rich in wealth with places to find these scores. And a lot of times you got to kind of go dip your fingers into, you know, not so legal sources, you know, like Russian music websites and stuff like that.
You have to deal with the KGB.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh God, do you have the top secret score that is out of print now?
Hopefully monkeys will save you if they ever come after you, though.
At the end of the year, when I kind of compose my thoughts, and I mean, I guess that's now since we're in December, and I start thinking about, okay, what music did I love this year? And I know that Forbidden Kingdom's one of them. I know that I loved the Rambo theme score. Mainly just that one cut I just thought was absolutely fantastic at the end. And then probably The Dark Knight, because right. I love James Newton Howard as well. He's somebody who I think has had some great scores in the past. But I think the immersion of Hans Zimmer and him was fantastic on these two Batman films, and Dark Knight score was really nice. Do you know that? Of course, they put out a Dark Knight CD, and now that it's coming out on DVD, they're going to put out a double special edition. How convenient was that?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just read about that, and I also read that because there was too many people involved in making the score now, that it was disqualified. The Dark Knight score was disqualified for any sort of Oscar.
Really?
Acknowledgement. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was like, holy shit, are you kidding me?
Wow.
Yeah, you know what it is? And that's like what your dad was saying. You hire a composer like you would an actor, but instead, a lot of times today, they're hiring composers to do their bidding. So it's kind of like they just say, well, let me plug you in and I'll make you do what I want you to do, as opposed to, you know, we hired John Barry because we want a beautiful sweeping score. We want we want what he can offer us, as opposed to, plugging someone in and making them work.
Yeah. It's like hiring someone to paint the Sistine Chapel, but you tell them exactly what to do and you don't let them use any of their artistic flair. You know, any of their artistic knowledge, even, because a lot of times the composer is also using their knowledge of the story and the characters and the emotional ties that you would have viewing the film.
Exactly.
With the music, and it doesn't feel like that. Was there an Iron Man theme, a Tony Stark theme, or anything like that? No, it's just like.
Yeah.
Working on the Iron Man suit. And it's just like when I watch a film, I really love Iron Man, but I'm just like, man, it could have been so much more. And The Incredible Hulk, I don't even remember the music from that.
Yeah, I don't either in any way.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be a memorable score. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it just needs to bring something to the film besides...
Well, you know what? There, like, you and I and your dad, and I know that there's other people in our audience who are that way. I know that it's a different thing, because we're not only going there and listening to it for that amount of time, because there's a second life to film music. Because, you know, it's like you can take it, you can put it on a CD, put it in your iPod, and you listen to it, and you can let it be. It has a life of its own outside of the movie. I know that when I'm listening to a score, even if it's so tied to a film like Star Wars, but I don't necessarily think about Star Wars when I'm listening to it, you know?
Right.
And that's what really has happened a lot today, like your dad said, is that it's become to where it's so tied to the film that it doesn't have a life of its own, and you can't listen to it. And so that's why it matters to us. You know what I mean? Because I still long for the days and love the days when a great new score comes out, you know, and it's just like, wow, I'm so excited that, you know, because really, I mean, classical music is classical music.
Right.
Where else can you find orchestrated music that's new and original and unique today? Well, they don't make music like that just for the sake of making music. It's a very rare thing that you can find on a mass marketed level. You know, you can go to a university and, you know, presenting the works of so-and-so, where a music student will you can hear his stuff. But, you know, you can't go to a store or go online and find this kind of stuff. So really, if you love an orchestral sound, a huge orchestral sound, beyond the difference between classical music, which is, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, well, if I'm in the mood for classical music, I want to listen to the great or classic stuff. But if you want modern, this is really the only format you have. And so it lives outside of the films. And more, the sadness is that that's not happening. I think you and I, like we said, we're a little more optimistic than your dad is, but there's absolutely no doubt you see it.
Yeah.
You know, the great days of before are gone.
Right.
But, you know, we still get a few nuggets here and there.
Yeah. Well, it's like he said, you know, he'll watch a movie like Elizabeth the Golden Age and love the score. And I'm hoping something like when Star Wars came along and it blew everyone away and they're like, we got to do this. I'm hoping a movie like that happens. Maybe, who knows? I wonder what the soundtrack to The Watchmen is going to be like. It'd be awesome. Hopefully, the 300 score did nothing for me. I'm sorry, Tyler Bates or Brian Tyler, whoever the hell wrote it. But I want something to blow me away, you know?
Right.
It's a big story. It's a big movie. Blow me away. Don't hang out in the background, okay?
I think that 300, you remember, I didn't really necessarily like 300, but I think that if you take, you know, if I could go back and temp that thing with Basil Polidori's music and make it badass.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
That's what
I could I could rip that music score out of there, put in something that's Basil Polidori's like, you know, take, you know, Starship Troopers a little bit here and take a little bit of Conan and that kind of thing. You could make that movie so much stronger.
And you know what was sad is the Nine Inch Nails music on the trailer was more powerful than the music in the movie, I thought.
Well, you know what? Well, and look, they're doing the same thing with the Smashing Pumpkins theme for Watchmen. So I'm, you know, I'm a little worried, you know, we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, I'm a little bit, that music isn't the same. The Nine Inch Nails just work perfectly with the 300 trailer.
Right, exactly. And it may have been an afterthought to where they'd already finished the film. And then the person making the trailer said, oh, let's use this and score this. And it's like, oh, well, that works perfectly. And
I would have said, we got to get Trent Reznor to do the film at that point. You know, he did.
Oh, right. Exactly. Well, he did. He's done video games before. So
I believe, didn't Trent Reznor do, or he might have just produced Natural Born Killers. I can't remember what aspect he did of that.
But I think he helped produce the CD soundtrack that came out, or he was kind of a music supervisor or something.
Right.
I know he did one song on there, that Burn song. But I think he might have been a music supervisor on it, but I don't know that he did any scoring. He did the original music for Quake, the first Quake.
Right, I remember that.
And, you know, it's more, not really a lot of soundtrack. So it would be interesting. I'm shocked that he hasn't had the opportunity to.
I think he has it in him, definitely.
Oh, I do too. I think there's certain people that you can see in the music industry, you know, that could do that. I mean, look at the guy who's a big composer now, who I hate as a composer, guys we love to hate. Trevor Rabin, I loved with Yes. Those last few albums, I really loved him, you know, in the 80s, Owner of a Lonely Heart and all, if you remember that stuff.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But now he's jumped into composing, and I hate his stuff. I thought automatically, oh, it's exciting to see him do it, but I hate his scores because they're just, you know, ticka 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 ticka. They have no thematic resonance in any way whatsoever.
Do you remember when Philip Glass, remember he did the Koyaanisqatsi?
Yeah,
he was like, hey, let's get this guy to score a film. He'll do, what was that film he did? Oh, shit, I can't believe I just blanked on it. Didn't he do Candyman, the music, too?
He did a score recently that I saw something, too, and I was like, oh, my God, and it sounded like real music.
Yeah, that's what's like, please don't do the Koyaanisqatsi shit.
Yeah, you know? I was like,
people walking real fast, they're shopping, they're the sun's going up, it's going down, it's cloudy, yeah. It's not cloudy anymore. I remember when my dad rented that. You know, it was back in the days of VHS and going to the rental place. And he's like, I rented this movie called Koyaanisqatsi. We're going to watch it. It's like, what? So we're sitting there watching that. It's like 10 minutes. Like, I can't take any more of this shit. Turn it off.
Yeah.
You're killing me.
I appreciate what it is, but I don't find myself watching it a lot.
Yeah,
it's like stock footage, and it does have an overall theme, but
it's,
you know,
life
the whole
out of
film.
Balance or something. Yeah, I appreciate it from the other room.
Yeah. Oh, I know what it was. My wife watched No Reservations on Cinemax, and he had done that score, and it sounded like real music. And I was like, oh my God, Philip Glass?
Is that with Aaron Eckhart and Catherine Zeta-Jones?
Yeah. Every time I hear the word Eckhart, I always think, Eckhart.
Oh, yeah, from Batman.
Number one. Yeah. Oh, man. So I don't know. As far as
think
as
about your future. Sorry, that just popped in. How come they always get big, fat, slobby, dirty cops in Batman movies? Because then they had the guy in Batman Begins,
yeah,
eating his falafel.
Yeah, how did he pass the? How did he pass the test? You know.
Yeah, I love that line. How am I going to feed my kids? Don't they like falafel? Yeah. That was great.
Oh, man. So I don't know. As far as where music is going today, I have to just hope. I know that, you know, when you go to the past, that's where the wealth is. That's where right. the gold is,
and
you
that,
know?
The best thing about it is music is forever, and you can always go back and watch those films. That's one thing that I've talked to my dad about. Like, when you get – say you've listened to – I'm sure he's overplayed a James Bond track or whatever,
sure.
a certain movie, he could go back and watch the movie and appreciate it with the movie, and that gives it a new life also. You know, that's the reason it was written in the first place.
Right. Well, and how many movies are bad that have a great score?
Right.
You know,
John Barry did Howard the Duck, and I think it's an incredible score, actually.
It's wonderful. I remember I owned it, and I wore the cassette down and never made a DVD of it. Now, luckily, I've been able to get some digital files of it. But it was wonderful. I mean, you know, bad movie. I mean, think what did John Barry do for King Kong in 1976?
It's just – it's so layered.
It's a wonderful score. And everyone kind of sees it as a silly movie, and it is kind of silly. But I will always have a love for, you know, the 1976 Jessica Lange King Kong, and most of it is because of that John Barry score.
Yeah.
Because it's just – it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's just – John Barry was like this name in our household that we always knew because we were raised on it. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
We were raised on John Barry, so it's just a name that always pops into your head.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, John Barry was always really important to my wife and I because, you know, we were very movie – I was movie hungry when I was in college, and we watched so many movies, and we bought scores. And I just remember, like I said earlier, Somewhere in Time – Out of Africa, I mean, on and on and on. The scores, we would just listen and listen and listen and listen and listen to those things. And like I said, so much so, Dances with Wolves, so much so that, you know, it became so much a part of our life. We put it in our wedding and that kind of deal.
Right.
So, he's had some great scores. He's had some gore scores that I just, you know, are kind of forgettable.
Well, I've always loved his Midnight Cowboy theme.
Oh, the harmonica. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Did you get his kind of compilations that he put out?
Oh, Moviola?
Yeah.
And then there was the second one too.
Yeah, there's two of them. And really just a fantastic
thing. I know.
I mean, I love having the original scores. Probably more, but yeah. You know, just if you're going to get a greatest hits kind of a thing,
I guarantee you most people have heard the Somewhere in Time and
Somewhere in Time is like, that's a huge, huge, huge popular score.
Right. And Out of Africa.
Oh, yeah. It's just so gorgeous. Like I said, when you go to heaven, okay, whether or not people believe in heaven or not, I'm just going to say, you know, my blue heaven. Okay, my heaven. That's what's going to be playing. You know, it's going to be John Barry, Jerry Goldsmith, you know, some of the most beautiful music you've ever heard.
Yeah.
I mean, just remember how gorgeous it was, the Untouchables music instead of going to the pop, 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 they switch to the real pretty music. That's the music I love the most from Untouchables. It's not the, not when, the da-da-dun.
When he's sitting da-dun. With his daughter.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff is just so fantastic. So that stuff just, it lives outside of the film. It becomes part of your life. It's like, you know, that's the one thing that's wrong with our lives, isn't it? That we don't have a composer scoring our life.
Yeah.
You know, and you wonder, God, who would score my life? Who would be my composer? You know, and you think, well, John Barry, well, I don't know. That's kind of
It'd be Brian Tyler. Brian Tyler Bates. That's what it is. It's just a guy with three names. Brian Tyler Bates.
It's a before and after on Jeopardy, yeah.
But yeah, I know. Like, it's, music is a part of, should be a part of everyone's life. And especially, you know, you need that. A lot of times when you're stressed out and stuff, just chilling out and listening to some music helps, you know?
Oh, yeah, and especially stuff like this. I mean, you know, if I want to chill out and relax, it's hard for me to put on, you know, some hard rock. A lot of people like that. That's great. It's all taste. I mean, everyone loves music, you know? You ever meet those people who go, hey, I'm a real fan of music? Yes, you and everybody else on planet Earth.
Yeah.
You know? But I know that specifically for me, when I talk about, you know, music I intrinsically love at the bottom of my soul. You know, sure, I like Genesis and Phil Collins, and you know, I have my favorites, you know, through the years. Everyone does of rock music that you like and whatnot. But stuff that it's the base of me, it's this deep, rich, orchestral, you know, film scores.
Right.
And I think that, you know, I have a hard time believing that anyone wouldn't appreciate that. Like I said, you said earlier, it's sad when you see people go, oh, that's like easy listening, like your dad said. Mm-hmm. They're not willing to get past their biases to, you know, only rock and roll and listen to stuff that's deeper and richer.
Right.
But, you know, it's all personal opinion in the end, and it's all self-indulgent, whichever way we like personally to go. Yeah. I have a hard time not pushing, you know, beautiful scores on people, just saying, you know, just, yeah, but, you know, and people get moved by film scores as well, and they don't even realize it. You know, it's like, oh, such a great movie. Well, that's, the music had a lot to do with it, a lot to do with it. There's times when I'm deciding whether or not I'm going to watch a movie, and if I see a name on there, it's music by so-and-so, I'm like, oh, well, okay, I'm watching it.
Yeah, I barely recognize names anymore on certain movies, you know, like Brian Tyler or something. why is that my default today? I don't know.
Brian Tyler Bates. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of new guys coming up, and there's a lot, they're trying out these new people. And it's interesting because I know that Ridley Scott just put out a new movie, this Body of Lies. And I was like, who the hell is that on the composer? I need to pull it up.
Body
just to make
of
sure.
Lies. Yeah.
Original music by Mark Streitenfeld.
Who?
For Body of Lies. Exactly. So there's all these people. Now, hey, who's to say that Mark Streitenfeld isn't someone in the future who we're going to grab, you know, who we're going to really enjoy? And I haven't seen Body of Lies, so I can't say. But that's an example, really, of...
Yeah, it could be incredible.
People, yeah, people taking tries. And so a lot of times we're seeing these new people, whereas in the past it was like you knew that if somebody was coming out with a film, that odds are it was this kind of film, you're going to have like 5 or 10 choices.
Uh-huh.
On someone who you know for sure will be doing that score. And that's not necessarily the case anymore.
And I remember, you know, I mentioned Young Guns, my buddy Ray and I going, oh, it's cool, James Horner does the soundtrack. And we were all high on James Horner because he did Aliens.
Oh, and I was, way high on James
Horner. It was like,
Horner.
Oh, James Horner's doing Young Guns. That looks badass, man. Oh, man. And then we go see it in the theater, and it's like music by generic guy. And it's like, huh?
Like, what?
When did this happen? And if you, to this day, I'll watch Young Guns and go, this soundtrack sucks. You know, where the hell's James Horner's score? I've always wanted to hear it. I don't know if anyone has it or has ever heard it, but I guarantee you it's 20 times better than the track that they chose for the movie.
Yeah. Well, that's that Lost Scores. And yeah, I loved James Horner back in those early days when he did the Star Trek 2 and 3. I was so in love with that music.
Oh, yeah.
Cocoon. Cocoon
Project
Return
X.
Is so freaking horrible. It's such a bad movie. It's one of the worst movies in history.
The only,
I've talked about this before in the saloon, the only way that I can even think about it is that it never happened, you know? That's a whole show right there, a show called Never Happened. But Horner came back, did the score, reprised some of his themes, and it's still some beautiful music.
Right.
So,
at what point did you go, hey, wait a second, this sounds kind of like Newt's theme from Aliens?
Well, you know, what's funny is that he really, more than a lot of people, has borrowed from himself.
Yeah.
You really listen to the 48-hour score and then listen to the Commando score.
Oh, I know. Or Red Heat. They're the same.
They're all the same with that.
Yeah. And there's a na 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 na. He did Clear and Present Danger, I think, too. And that has Newt's theme in it. Project X, Newt's theme. It's in more than one movie.
Yeah.
Just watch Project X and Aliens and you're like, "What? Huh?"
Yeah, I know. It's exactly the same. Well, but you know, he did scores like, I'm looking at his Wikipedia page right now, Field of Dreams and Glory and In Country in the same year. It's like if he did a soundtrack, I would usually pick it up like automatically on CD. I even bought the Dad soundtrack.
Wow.
Frickin' Dad.
And you
okay?
know what? I always wondered about. They also said the Young Guns, the director said it was too Irish sounding, Irish ethnic folk music y. And wow. I always wondered, I bet you this sounds a lot like Braveheart, you know? Because I know that's Scottish, but if you go and listen to Braveheart and they go, then listen to that old Young Guns, it's like, oh, he recycled his old Young Guns track. I always wondered that.
It's so funny. Yeah, he does. He regurgitates a lot of his stuff. But when you're so prolific, yeah. I mean, all right, I'm looking at 1993. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 scores in 1 year. I mean, that's absurd. So, you know, you got to get to a point to where you're just saying, okay, I'm going to have to just do something that's a little close at this point.
I believe he did Kroll, too, which has a rocking soundtrack. Have you ever listened to Kroll?
Oh, yeah, I have it. Yeah, definitely.
But the one thing...
That was in his early days.
Yeah.
He did that the same year he did Brainstorm, and Brainstorm is gorgeous.
Oh, my God, it is. It is. It's so powerful.
Gorgeous music.
And the thing is, I will say this about him, even though, yeah, he does use some of the same music, it always works in the context of the movie.
Sure, absolutely.
Newt's theme has worked in several movies. But also, I was like in, I think it's Search for Spock. Didn't he do that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The Klingon. Bum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum. It sounds just like Aliens. That. But he added that cling cling. That's different. There's no cling cling in the Star Trek, I don't think. But
yeah. Ching ching. Oh, yeah. Well, and it was all done so close in proximity to each other. It's like he did Star Trek 3 in 84, and then what was Aliens?
Oh, yeah, it was 86? What was it?
I'm looking. It was 86, yeah. So it's so, you know, and it's a similar thing. And, yeah, I'm amazed at how prolific some of these amazing composers are, but they're still able to do scores that are just absolutely fantastic. I'm excited because I just saw on here that he's actually doing the score for Avatar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's
one
good.
Thing. James Cameron, I actually saw him speak at the Terminator convention,
mm-hmm.
and he said the one thing that he can't do, he does everything on his movies. He can't do music. He's not a musician. He has to leave it up to the musician. He, like Brad Fidel, he used Brad Fidel in Terminator, naturally. Terminator 2,
right.
True Lies. Alan Silvestri, I don't know how that happened for The Abyss, but it did. But yeah. I always wondered, why didn't he use James Horner for The Abyss? That would have been my natural go-to guy.
Yeah, and it could have been that maybe he was already, you know, doing something else.
Yeah, it's like, I'm already doing 10 other movies.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I think that would have been a much better fit.
And he couldn't have used Newt's theme in The Abyss. It would have been too obvious because it was a James Cameron film. James Cameron would have figured it out.
Oh, so funny. Well, you know, it's like, if you listen to the opening to Aliens, there's some music in there that he used from Aliens that he took from a piece of classical music, and it's almost exactly that theme. I don't remember what it was.
You know what's funny is I always recognize that there's one moment when the Queen Alien comes down the elevator, and there's the cue, the Jerry Goldsmith cue. Do you ever recognize that from Alien? Sound.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's his, hey, remember Alien? Jerry Goldsmith did that. And
yeah.
Because I love that the Jerry Goldsmith Alien score. There's that, I can't remember what it's called on the soundtrack. Because picture when I'm a little kid, my dad always had records leaning against a wall, and I would read what the track was called. And
right.
I would play that on the stereo while he was at work. Honestly, I don't think he would like me touching his turntable, but there was this piece on the Aliens that dun 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 dun. Scary thing, and I would like listen to that over and over again. I thought it was so cool.
That's great. Yeah. James Horner is definitely one of my favorites. I mean, you know, just how many times did you listen to Legends of the Fall? I mean, just that to me. Now, I know a lot of people love the film, but I don't necessarily love the film. But I love the music. I love it.
Yeah. I have. I'm with the film until a certain point where you go, come on, how much more could happen to this family? All of a sudden, Anthony Hopkins is Popeye over there with a chalkboard. He's like, I hate that. It pulls you out of the movie. He's doing a Popeye impression all of a sudden. When Brad Pitt's wife is killed, it's just like, oh, come on.
Yeah,
it's like, do you remember watching the Swiss Family Robinson when you were a kid, or was it the Wilderness Family? I don't know what I'm thinking of. Maybe it's the Wilderness Family.
Yeah,
but they're snowed in. Oh my God, how are they going to get out? Oh my God, a cougar's attacking, a bear's attacking. Oh, there's a fire. It's just like, what else can happen to this family? And it would drive me nuts. That's what I felt with Legends of the Fall.
Yeah,
like I was waiting for a bear to attack, and it does finally at the end.
Yeah.
Hey, the bear finally is attacked.
The bear won.
What would you say? It's just over the head. I don't know. They just go.
Yeah, I think it just gets into corny. They're trying to make it like Legend, you know, and he became one with the mighty bear.
Yeah, we are no longer brothers.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think it goes too far, but. You know, it's one of those movies, again, where it's like the score so outshines.
And it always bothers me. Julia Ormond, she's cute, but not that hot.
Not that freaking hot to go for three brothers.
Yeah, to disown your brother. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think Brad Pitt could have, you know, or whatever his character was named. Could have worked that out.
I remember his name because it became the hot name for newborns that year.
Oh, Tristan.
Yeah, Tristan.
Give me a freaking break.
That's a movie totally for women. Tristan with his flowing hair. Meanwhile, yeah. I'm going to be playing Pac-Man in the lobby, all right?
Yeah.
But the soundtrack is great, though.
Yeah, and that's just another example of, you know, I think there's many, many films that, you know, like your dad said he didn't like Cutthroat Island, but I kind of like the Cutthroat Island score. That John Debney guy, if you remember, he also did the, remember the theme to Sequest? I loved that, you know? It was like, dun, 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 dun. You know, it was so up. Watch this Star Trek ripoff, Under Space.
That's like Outer Space, only underwater.
Yep.
Good old Roy Scheider.
Well, see, that's the deal. If it was Roy Scheider, it had to be good, you know, for at least until you got into the 90s.
I watched it for the dolphin.
Yeah.
Well, what more can we say about music other than we love it, and we love talking about it, and we love to hear what everyone else has to say about it. And it'd be great to do another show, wouldn't it, Andy? Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just so much more to talk about, especially with your dad being the wealth of information and passion for this thing. I could talk to him for hours about this. So it was great, great. Thank you very much for hooking me up and letting me be a part of this, because it's great to talk about composers and music and where it is today. And
no problem. It was a blast.
Definitely.
And we'll do it again. And I want to thank everybody for listening and supporting Nowhere in Mulberry and the Saloon. Right, Andy?
Mulberry Saloon. That's right.
Without you guys, we'd just be listening to ourselves talk.
Exactly. Which we're good at. Yeah, absolutely.
But thank you, everybody. And we'll see you next time. All right. And we'll close out to some beautiful music.
Ah.
Cue Iron Man soundtrack.
Now this is podcasting.